All right, it is 5:30, and we are going to call the April 7th, 2020 meeting of the Tompkins County Legislature to order. Can you all, please, those of you who are in chambers, rise and join me in the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Thank you. Roll call of members.
Martha Robertson. Mike Sigler.
Here.
Shauna Black.
Here.
Amanda Champion.
Here.
Deborah Dawson?
Here, sort of.
Henry Granison?
Present.
Rich John?
Here.
Anna Kellis?
Here.
Dan Pine?
Here.
Ann Corman?
Present.
Mike Lane?
Here.
Dave McKenna?
Here.
Glenn Morey?
Here.
Leslyn McBean Claiborne?
Present.
13 members present.
Thank you. Proclamations, petitions, communications, and notices?
Communications have been distributed.
All right, you all would have received any communications. Any executive sessions? No, no call for executive session tonight. One of the things I want to ask all of you to do, I want to appreciate that this is very different, conducting a meeting this way. We're all working with a whole different technology way of doing business, and so I appreciate everyone's patience. And one of the things I need to ask you to do is please make sure that you are speaking clearly and loudly into your microphone so that we can hear you well. Martha has arrived. So did everybody hear that?
Yes.
We're going to proceed with the meeting, and we will be doing, again, roll call votes. Because we can't quite, you know, get your head nodding, and so it may take a little longer as we go through everything. So if you have reports, again, we ask that you be a little crisp with it. So we are going to move right along. Privilege of the floor for the public. We did not receive any emails or anything from the public for that part of it. There is one email I received that I'm going to read as part of my chair's report. Municipal officials, we did receive an email from Robert Lynch, councilperson from the town of Enfield, and I will read his report. It says, as one of five members of the Enfield Town Board, speaking only for myself as councilperson, allow me to update you on recent matters affecting Enfield Town government that may be of interest countywide and to your legislature. Leadership, at our town board meeting March 11th, our supervisor Beth McGee announced her plans to resign. She gave April 30th as her likely departure date. Contrary to some misleading media reports, McGee did not resign at the meeting, nor has she, to my knowledge, filed any paperwork to formalize her planned departure. Instead, the supervisor has stated that the COVID-19 emergency will delay her departure indefinitely. Through this state of emergency, and these are in quotes, I will continue to serve the town of Enfield as is my prerogative, in order to provide consistency and confidence that our municipality can protect residents as they expect. McGee shared in an email to town board members March 4th. just 3 days after her initial announcement. Response to COVID-19. Bob went on to say, I stand relieved that Supervisor McGee has postponed her departure. We in Enfield have enough on our plate at the moment without addressing a leadership change as well, and they'll keep us informed as matters unfold. Response to COVID-19, to affect social distancing, we, like your legislature, have chosen to meet remotely via conferencing, so the Enfield Town Board is doing the same video conferencing. Our first Zoom meeting conference was on April 1st, and they will meet again tomorrow evening, April 28th, by Zoom. By county government, our town board is working to address financial uncertainty. Last Wednesday, we adopted a short-term resolution freezing any hiring or big-ticket purchases, with the exception of a part-time deputy's position, an existing vacancy already well on its way to being filled. Likely they will finalize hiring and spending freeze this Wednesday. Since March 18th, the Highway Superintendent's direction, the Enfield Highway Department has operated on work-from-home rules. The order means that most highway work has been suspended except for weather-related emergency duties, of which our highway department staff remains on call. The food pantry, he wanted to share some information that the demand has swelled for the Enfield food pantry, a volunteer service that the town supports. It's located, the pantry is located on the first floor of the Enfield Community Building. Services patrons 2 days a week. It's open Sundays and Mondays. And will continue to do so. COVID-19 compatible procedures have stressed organizers to the limit. The pantry has effectively transitioned these recent weeks to a pre-order system and curbside pickup. Patrons must now order their meals online or by phone, with scheduled pickups as patrons drive past the pantry's entrance. Last week, they served more than 400 families, nearly double the averages pre-COVID-19, and distribute over 40,000 pounds of food and essentials weekly. Thanks to Director Jean Owens and Laura Norman, formerly with our Board of Elections, for making the pre-ordering process work. So just some information on what's going on in Enfield, the town of Enfield, from Robert Lynch. Thank you very much for the municipal report. And I'm sorry, I can't answer any questions on behalf of Robert. First, there's a floor for legislators. Anybody wants to say anything? Share anything that's coming up? Anne, and then Martha.
Hi. Hi, everybody. So one of the things that I realized I probably should have shared with Shauna and HHS, but the last week or two I've been working with some seniors in the town of Ulysses at a couple of the senior multifamily residences we have here. And we're working with the County Office for the Aging and the Health Department on some specific handouts and posters for the elderly, weaving in Matilda's Law and some other things that we found pertinent. And so it's kind of like a test run, and it's something that could be used in other senior centers or maybe to seniors in general. So I just wanted to let folks know about that.
Thank you. Martha?
Thank you. Hello, everybody. I want to I can talk about this what happened in the detail in the state budget during the budget, capital, and personnel report. But I just wanted, during this moment, give a big shout out to NYSAC, for the New York State Association of Counties, for organizing us, organizing counties, and articulating very well to the legislature the importance of the county's positions on many issues, but especially on Medicaid. And things came out relatively well compared to where we started at the beginning of the year. So we appreciate that. And I just wanted to wish everybody a good and safe Passover and Easter. I'll be joining dozens of family members by Zoom tomorrow night for a Seder, and many more people than we could ever fit into somebody's house. So maybe that's a little bit of a benefit, but that's just wish everybody good holiday. Thank you.
Thank you, Martha. Shauna, followed by Anna.
Yeah, I just wanted to thank all of our essential workers, our grocery workers, delivery drivers, our healthcare workers, the people that pick up our recycling and our trash. I feel like we are constantly praising you guys, but it definitely goes without saying that each time you leave your house, you put yourself at risk. And you do that to provide services that we all need. And I just want to thank each and every one of you. I also want to send a shout out to our public health department that has really absolutely been amazing. One of the correspondences that I've received from my constituents states, one, the health department staff is amazing. We're grateful that they are continuing to work and keep an upbeat and friendly attitude with our families. And just, you know, that's one of many that I've received, talking about the professionalism and the dedication of our staff. So I can't thank you enough. You are really and truly the heroes here in our community.
Thank you, Shauna. Anna?
Thank you, Shauna. I want to second everything Shauna said. I won't repeat it, but a heartfelt thank you, Shauna, for sharing that. I want to also acknowledge that it's World Healthcare Worker Day. So everybody who lives with a healthcare worker has been loved and treated and cared for. Please give them a shout out today. If you live with them and are able to hug them, thank them for all of us. I just wanted to make sure everybody knew that and have a moment of appreciation and gratitude, and also a shout out to everybody who has stepped in to make masks. There's in the all of the volunteers at Cornell Bartel Hall. There are people in their homes who've switched gears with everything in their lives, and they're making masks. There's 3D printer masks all going out to our healthcare workers, but now they're starting to go out to essential services. I saw an email go out for masks going to even right now our TCAT drivers. Deeply appreciate that. Another shout out, there's a Facebook group called Mutual Aid Tompkins, and I think that it's been a boon for a lot of people. I know I've been following it, and it's been very helpful. There's Ithaca Issues. There's a lot of different groups, and it's been really inspiring to see everyone supporting each other and reaching out and figuring out creative ways to reach each other during isolation. So for everybody who's pretty much all of us who are experiencing the isolation, I hear it. I feel you. I'm with you. And thank you for everybody's creative way of trying to stay connected. So just a shout out to pretty much everyone. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, Anna. Shauna, do you still have your hand raised to speak again, or you just forgot to take it down? Thank you. Mike Lane?
I want to talk about the elections that have been postponed and will be coming up again, because I think it's so important. I think we probably all understand how important elections are, being elected officials ourselves. We're looking at the resolution later tonight to talk about a different way of trying to get more people to vote. Having an election, whether it's primaries, whether it's special elections, whether it's school board elections, whether it's presidential primaries and presidential elections is so very, very important. And we should not criticize candidates if they are doing their best to figure out how to raise funds, how to get their names out, how to say what their issues are through electronic means and whatever they can do, lawn signs. That is so terribly important. And I hearken back to 1864 and President Abraham Lincoln, who fought very strongly to have a national election in the middle of the Civil War. A lot of his team of rivals, who were his cabinet, recommended that because of the state of emergency, they postpone the presidential election. And to his credit, Lincoln would have none of that. And he wasn't terribly popular in a lot of places. The cities particularly, there were things like draft riots going on. There were lynchings of African-American people after the Emancipation Proclamation. There were other things that were making people unhappy. He was running against the general that he had sidelined because he wasn't prosecuting the war fast enough for Lincoln's feeling about how we needed to get it done. The election happened. They predicted that Lincoln wouldn't get reelected, but it was the people on the front lines, the people who were the soldiers, that elected Lincoln and returned him for a second term. And I think that's a wonderful example because the Constitution and the election was more important than the crisis that the country was in at that time. And we need to think about that with elections. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Anyone else? Yes, Annie?
I just want to follow up on what some other folks said about the people that are out there making sure that the necessary services are provided, whether it's, health care. And some people say, have been calling them heroes, and some people have said that they don't like the name heroes, but I just wanted to acknowledge those folks. I mean, often heroes know what they're signing up for, and I just want to say that these folks did not know what they signed up for. Everybody knows somebody. My sister works in healthcare, but she didn't sign up to not have enough protective equipment for herself. And my brother signed up to work at UPS, but he didn't sign up for this, and he also is struggling to have any protective equipment. But both of them need to work. They need the money, but they also have children at home. So I just wanted to recognize that aspect of it and thank those people. And we're trying to help them as much as they can.
Thank you. Anyone else? All right. At this point, it's usually a special presentation or legislative discussion, which I was going to invite Jason and Frank, Amy, and others to speak. But if you'd allow me to just do a little switcheroo, I want to get just a little portion out of the way just for me in terms of Chair's report. I do want to say a great big thank you and echo Shauna, Annie, and Anna. To everyone who has been working around the clock, 24/7, above and beyond, to help us in our fight against this virus in our community, saving lives, helping people to do the right thing, etc. Everyone from our medical professionals, the folks at Keoga Medical Center, to the folks in our EOC, to the folks who own businesses and are trying to make sure that supplies are here for our community's needs, to those who are facing very serious difficulties business-wise, but still trying to hang on, to you, our legislators, who have been getting messages out and speaking and calming community in ways that you probably didn't think you'd be doing. to some of the other leaders in our community who are doing the same thing. Today, just being on a phone call, a conference call, and listening to folks talk about what we can do for young people who are used to, when the weather's nice, being out, playing basketball, letting steam off, and what does it mean for them, and folks trying to figure out ways to allow for young people to have some interaction, though distance, whether it's one person on a basketball court shooting a basketball for 15 minutes, then they leave and someone else. Just people trying to figure it out so that, you know, folks don't get too stressed out is extremely, extremely important. Our folks at the mental health department and those in mental health practice, because we know so many people are facing some serious concerns and serious issues dealing with this. So I just wanted to say a great big thank you, and to our residents who are also paying attention, helping to support each other, our higher education institutions, doing more than, you know, they have done in the past, or doing different things than they have done in the past, to make sure that everyone gets what they need and that people are protected in the best way that we can do possible. So thanks to all of those individuals and more. I received a message from a gentleman after the Swift 911 message went out on Sunday. Several people called, several people emailed, were very thankful. So thanks to the communications team of our EOC for putting a plan together that folks can hear from their elected leaders to know that, yes, we are paying attention and we are a part of trying to help stop this spread. So the message I wanted to read pretty much sort of speaks to what I wanted to share tonight. It's a thank you for the recorded message to remember hand washing, stay at home, and 6 feet physical distance. And I want to emphasize that this is not just my message. It's a message that came from all of us, from all of the community. It might have been my voice, but it's something that we're all saying. He went on to say, I agree with all the suggestions, but many people are not practicing distancing to protect others. The requirements can only work if a majority of the population practices them. We are only as strong as our weakest link. That is why we are still at risk, and distancing isn't working 100% or nearly enough. I went into a store last month wearing a mask and gloves, and the clerk, a gentleman in his 20s, said to me, "The sky is falling, the sky is falling," as if to say I was overreacting and there isn't a problem. Then a relative of ours was outside his house talking to his neighbor, and he said to her, he wouldn't come too close because of the virus epidemic. Her reply was, "Don't you know this infection is a hoax? If you look at our population in the U.S., we are almost 50% of the population with health issues, from obesity to smoking issues, alcohol issues, and so much more. A large part of our population make bad decisions to cause their own premature death, probably because of issues of poverty or ignorance or lack of knowledge, etc. But you are now asking them to be careful so they don't infect other people. Many people wouldn't do that, especially if they are carriers and don't have symptoms yet. As you know, many younger people are contracting the disease and are dying, along with older people with pre-existing conditions. We should not be saying protect your mom, dad, uncle, and older folks. We should be saying stay 6 feet away, wash your hands, stay home, If you don't, you could get gravely ill or you could die. We are just saying the same thing in a different way. We want to save your life. If you don't practice what we tell you, you could risk death. Put that sign up all over Ithaca, he asked, and you will see the positive test rate drop. I don't think we have much of a curve yet, but maybe we can block the curve before we need to flatten it. Thank you all, he said, thank you all for what you are doing. My wife had a fever a month ago, and since she is a pancreatic cancer survivor of 4 years and doesn't have a spleen either, she was tested for COVID-19 along with other tests. Before the test came back negative, the Department of Health called every day and advised us what to do and what not to do. They not only did a great job to keep the virus away from others, if we indeed had it, but they made us feel more secure that the Department of Health here in Ithaca was doing a good job and helping us. We have a good team here in Ithaca. Thank you for all your part in it. Mel Solomon. I read his message because it sums up what I wanted to say. Please stay home if you do not have to go out. Cover your coughs and sneezes. Wash your hands. I came today wearing my homemade mask. It's something that we're pushing now. You know, wear a mask or face covering if you have to go out. Keep us at least a minimum 6 foot distance between you and the other person. And look out for each other. Social distancing does not mean not checking in on people. It's physical distancing, but please continue to check on each other, check on your neighbors, make sure that people are getting their needs met. Please continue to push folks calling 211. We have an amazing system set up to help people get their needs met. So please continue to push that. And again, I want to echo Mr. Solomon's comments with a great big thank you to the health department for doing the stellar job. Yes, not everybody is sharing this sentiment, but we know that you are doing an amazing job, and we want to thank you. So again, to our general public, I implore you to please pay attention. This is not a hoax. This is real. This is very real. I spent some time watching a program on MSNBC, it might have been two nights ago, called Into the Red Zone, where reporters went into Italy and reported on what was happening. They went into a hospital there, overflow, and just watching people, one person after another, ventilators after ventilators. And just a conversation with the staff about, you know, the trauma they're feeling with people dying because of this disease. Please, if nothing else, think about the other person. Think about your own life. And again, I implore all of us to please follow the directions, the guidance is coming out from our health department, from our CDC, from our state health department, and from all of us as your legislators, encouraging you to do the right thing. Thank you.
Well, sir.
We are going to move on and invite our county administrator and our director of health departments, who are somewhere in there. You are in a tiny box, so I can't see if you're there. I think you are. I see Jay Molino, yes, to please give us a briefing on what's going on with COVID-19 and how things are going.
Sure. Thank you, Leslie. Can everybody hear me all right? Good?
No.
No?
Yes.
Yeah. Get a little closer.
About now.
We can hear you, but no, we can't see you.
Right here. So just want to reiterate your message, Leslie, in terms of staying home, minimizing only essential travel only. And we thought it would be a good thing to do the lunch meeting tonight from the EOC. We're in the Emergency Operations Center. Generally, there's only about four or five of us in here. You can see Frank over here. He's definitely more than 6 feet. Amy's over here, well off screen. Jay Franklin's over here off screen. And I think Dominic, you can barely see him over there. So you can't see the whole room, obviously. But we thought it'd be good to do it up here. And actually, what I'd like to do is give Dominic and Amy put together a great presentation. I'm going to run through real quick. I'll share it with everyone. And it's kind of a little bit of a timeline. Believe it or not, we've been in here a little over 30 days now. And I thought it'd be good to kind of just go through a brief timeline to kind of remind folks of some things, on how some things have been transitioned. And we can send this presentation out to everyone as well. And then go from there. You can't see it, but over here, we've got, you know, daily briefing boards, checklists for the day, next day's activities or objectives, meeting schedules. And there's random, you know, large post-it notes of various quotes that we've put up throughout this, this exercise, motivational quotes and reflective quotes to keep our minds thinking. As we kind of go through this, so you can't really see all that, but that's kind of what the EOC looks like. So what I'll do is I'm going to put share a screen presentation up there for everyone, and we'll go through it quickly, and then answer any questions you have. Hold on 1 second, and then I'll confirm that everybody can see it.
Jason, you got to share it first before you.
Oh, I got to share it first. All right. Hold on 1 second.
Thanks, Adrian.
Frank is telling me I'm doing it wrong.
Share screen.
Frank doubles as our IT director when Greg's not around. All right.
You can make it full screen.
No, make it.
All right. Can everybody see that?
Yes.
All right. Great. All right. So, like I said, Dom and Amy put this together today. We thought it'd be good to kind of reflect a little bit on what we've done over the past 30 days. And this is really just from the perspective of the Emergency Operations Center. This doesn't include the entire community-wide response. It doesn't include, you know, what our public health nurses and the public health department are doing. And they've been doing really, this is actually supposed to be April 7th, but what they've been doing really since January. But it does talk a little bit about the EOC. So it's not all encompassing. It's not a detailed list of activities, but it kind of gives some touch points as to what we've been able to do over the past 30 days. So in January, it seems like decades ago that this started. And it really started in mid-January. So for our health department, they put a link up to the CDC about the coronavirus on the county website on January 24th. Cornell issues a statement about traveling to the Wuhan region, right? At that time, of course, we had no positive cases. And at February 3rd, Cornell made an announcement about a person having symptoms. They were placed in isolation. They obviously came back as a negative, but that was our first instance of isolation, but there were considerable quarantines that then followed that. At that point, then, there was a press release made by the health department advising of travel symptoms and other types of guidance. But as you can see, at the beginning of February, there was the beginning of more communications, primarily with higher ed, because they, at that time, travel was a major tie-in to symptoms and the positive cases. And discussions began both with school districts as well as with higher ed, and that's primarily out of our health department. So from early on, and I would say more than most counties in the state have have been engaged earlier in this process, primarily just due to a lot of the international travel that the community participates in. Early March, this is where we started to get involved in terms of county admin. Around the beginning of the later end of the week, just prior to the end of January, Frank said, Jason, you should probably sit down on this meeting. I think it was a Tuesday, March 3rd. And it's with some community partners. It's with higher ed. This is going to start to heat up, and we need to start getting prepared. And after that conversation, I'm meeting with those partners, and, you know, we can reflect now. But at that time.
Hey, Jason?
Yes.
The slides are not advancing. Are they supposed to be?
Yes. This one says March 2nd.
No, it's being stuck on whatever your cover page is.
All right. How about now? No?
No.
Nope.
Let me try it again, all right? Sorry about that.
So all the nice things you said, we couldn't follow. Right.
How about this? Can you see that? January Health Department?
There you go.
There you go.
All right. We're in business now. So here we are at the beginning of February, and throughout mid-February, discussions are taking place between the Health Department and primarily a lot of higher ed, some of the school districts, as kids are, you know, students are starting to come back, faculty are starting to come back from break, and there's more international travel going on. And also community members. This, you know, this community has a lot of international travel. Then at the beginning of March, as I was saying, this is where Frank and I talked, and you know, he said, you know, I think you need to come to this meeting with higher ed and some other community partners. CMC was there. And we need to start talking about what this might mean, because this is going to transition into more effort on our part to combat this. After that meeting and a series of discussions and talking internally, the next day I talked with Amy Hendricks and reassigned her to work with the Health Department on the response, because there was some additional support that was needed beyond just the immediate public health nurse responses and doing quarantine checks and isolation. We also then had an internal discussion with some of the larger department heads about what we foresee, you know, coming in this process and what we are going to need to be prepared for. And then we had meetings shortly after that. And then March 9th is when we had the first press conference about community preparedness with CMC and Frank and myself. At that point, you know, then really activity started to escalate. It really started to escalate that weekend prior to that conference call, prior to that press conference. And, you know, what happened the next week was a series of things that I think are relevant that really started the process. We did have our first positive case on 314, but if I back up before that, which would have been the latter part of that week, we had a series of conversations. At that time, the state, the governor the week just prior had declared a state of emergency based on what was going on downstate. There were then questions about, if you imagine, there were questions about mass gathering and what should be that size. That was the question. I remember having conversations with some of our economic development community partners to talk about what that would mean if we gave guidance on that. That's old news now, obviously. But towards the end of that week, it became very obvious after talking with our school districts and a great partnership conversation that we needed to act to take a proactive effort. And at the end of that week, we held a press conference where we issued declared a local state of emergency. At that time, we were the first county in the state and the only county in the state to declare a state of emergency that had not had a positive case. And we were also the first county in the state to coordinate a countywide school district closure collectively with our superintendent partners and the school district partners. And then the next day we had our first positive case. But shortly after that, within the next few days, most of all counties subsequently followed, and then school districts followed. And then obviously later on in that following week, the state then followed with closing school districts, I think a few days afterwards. At that point, we also activated the EOC, where we started to reassign certain staff members. So as you can see, Jay Franklin was in charge of planning, Jessica Verfus was logistics, Frank was in charge of operations, Amy was our EOC coordinator, and myself as the policy lead, which is really about helping coordinate and understand the direction of the response. And that's consistent with the incident command system and a lot of the emergency response training we've had. The next week and the following week after that, the 15th and then I think the 22nd, was really a roller coaster of changes that took place. You had a series every day, sometimes multiple times a day, a series of executive orders with really no forewarning by the state. And to a certain extent, understanding how fast things were changing, we might not have ever had forewarning. We had a series of planning initiatives, including critical services such as food, homelessness, transportation, childcare. Met with then individual groups, and then midweek, we got hit with the reduced workforce by 50%. At the same point in time, planning and execution was going on about working with CMC on setting up the first sampling site, which was over at Craft Road. By the end of that week, literally in 24 hours, I want to say 48 hours, we were able to meet and exceed the 50% reduction that the governor had requested in his executive order. I think we're still above 60% reduction right now. We started to add more folks to the EOC, that being the public information team. You can see two additional members of Jeremy and Shannon joined us at that point. A few days later then, you had the cascading of executive orders by the governor from a private sector, private business perspective, reducing one day 50%, the next day 75%, the next day zero workforce of non-essential businesses being open. Earlier in that week, we also dispersed more members in the EOC. So we, rather than having people come to the EOC, the sheriff, the PIO members, we said you can work remotely in order to protect ourselves and each other. Because while the room is fairly large, the more people you put in it, the more opportunity there is for exposure and the more close contact we are. Working, you know, coordinating with daycare providers, food bank, food issues, homelessness planning, all of this is happening with multiple people at simultaneous moments, as well as different executive orders being pushed out. And as you can imagine, that's not a one-way street. Multiple, you know, questions firing in left and right from the public, from the media, from elected officials across the county, where answers are still, you know, are being sought, trying to understand what goes on. And then we kind of dropped Dominic in the middle of it as his first day starting. And he just hit the ground running and has done a great job adjusting. A really great job adjusting. As you can see, my PowerPoint skills have been greatly enhanced because of him. You know, the following series of days then follows with, again, subsequent executive orders being issued, extensions of the first school closures, expansions or pushing back of things like local elections. County operations changes in terms of now we're supporting and throughout the whole week prior, really since Craft Road opened, then they shifted to more of a drive-through, greater capacity drive-through sampling site, which then opened up in Lansing, up at the mall, coordinated with TCAT to ensure that there remained an essential service. COPA then picked up some additional deliveries for food, which is generally not what they do, and then coordinated with mental health and substance abuse disorder providers. And on the communication side, Stay Home Tompkins was initiated by our PIO team, and that campaign began around that at that time as well. Towards the end of that week, we started to change our messaging, and this is just, you know, 10 days ago, I started to change the messaging of we need to stay home, and we need to minimize all non-essential travel. And here we are to kind of the current day in this past week or 7 days, you know. At our last legislature meeting, which was 317, March 17th, we had one positive case. We have 102 positive cases between legislative meetings. And now, mind you, there was an extra week in between because there were 5 weeks in March. But as you can see how quickly things have evolved, closures in the school businesses have been extended to the end of the month. We've done now continued next phases of discussion with respect to homelessness and homeless providers, housing providers, information with different food providers as they begin to establish themselves more. On the communication side, as we know, this past weekend we probably had the largest community spread announcement with the Wegmans Coffee Shop, and that was that was a lot of work, primarily by Frank and the Public Health Department over the weekend, coordinating with Wegmans, working with them and their leadership team to ensure we're giving good guidance to them as an employer, giving good guidance to the public so everybody understands what the message is, Amy, myself, Dominic, we're all involved in multiple conversations over the weekend, including myself and as well as Sam Ilson from the Public Health Department, along with multiple conversations with Wegmans to ensure they were getting the right guidance as to what they wanted to do moving forward. And that really captures to where we are today. Again, not all encompassing, but kind of as a touch point. Here's a picture from an opposite direction of the EOC, as you can see, all spread out. Here's some objectives with the EOC that we have in place that we took on as we were establishing the EOC and preparing to address multiple issues, anywhere from minimizing the spread of the disease and ensuring that county operations continue. Here's just some quick statistics, and I thought it was worth sharing. So between the March 7th and March 28th, here are some hours. There's a picture of all the PIOs on their morning brief that they go through. A joyous bunch they are. And just a kind of an example of total FTEs and hours worked, just a snapshot of the amount of commitment that these folks are participating in. A lot of the PIOs, I'm looking at them now, 1, 2, 3, 4, there are 5 different departments represented. They come from 5 different departments, the PIOs, to make up a 17-member, which is pretty remarkable. You know, they're doing things that they weren't normally doing on a daily basis and have been reassigned and have really done, my personal opinion, a remarkable job in terms of sending out messaging. Social media has, I think, they've done a great job staying on top of and promoting social media through different platforms, and I really done a remarkable work there. The planning team, which Jay heads up, has, again, multiple team members doing a lot of pre-planning and preparation, and Frank in operations, and Amy and I, as well as Jess here in the EOC, working with the basic operations coordination logistics. Again, just a snapshot of the amount of time and effort put in. Again, doesn't address the amount of time and effort that the Public Health Department has put in, and all the nurses in the Public Health Department, because the community nurses were also brought in to support the public health nurses as well over a period of time. Just a little bit on several areas that we're working on. Food. Schools have been a big part of ensuring food is delivered on a daily basis. They're doing it through several different means. FoodNet, again, huge partner for ensuring Meals on Wheels. Jessica and her group have just been phenomenal. And, again, the food bank continues to provide a lot of wholesale options for delivery. This is, again, an ever-evolving discussion, and I think will be expanded in the near future. Child care. Again, a lot of effort focusing and working with child care providers. Sue at the Child Development Council has been great to work with, and her partners has been a great connection to that community. You can see the licensed daycare facilities have provided a decent amount of spots for essential workers, and then also registered facility, which are in-home child care facilities, have not closed and still continue to provide necessary child care throughout this process. Employment, so just to be clear, I got schooled on this earlier by Natalie, who's one of our newest department heads at the Workforce Development Board, who's doing a great job working with TCAD, the Chamber, DIA, and a lot of the private business community. Just as a comparison, in 2008, weekly filings of unemployment insurance peaked at about 50 per week. So according to our Career Center data, the number of filings of unemployment insurance in the week of March 23rd was 348. The week of March 30th was 1,200. So you can see a big spike in the number of calls that have been received at the Career Center. This, just to be clear, are not rates of unemployment. That takes a lot more data to determine unemployment rates, but these are phone calls to the Career Center, and obviously compared to the last dip or recession, just tower over those number of calls. And Natalie, along with Jackie out of our Career Center, are working hard to redirect Tompkins Workforce Redirect to a great resource. We're going to start promoting it a lot more through our communications team on opportunities where employers are hiring, and we want to ensure that the public is aware of that so they can sign up if they have opportunities to work. And Natalie and as well as working with our partners at TCAD have done a great job setting up and promoting it. Community response, telehealth has started with several different partners, one being Reach Medical in our Southwest Park area. Outreach workers continue to be in touch with different various populations throughout the community. And there's been a work through the dewatering site transitions as that capital project progresses in the city of Ithaca. That kind of concludes just a brief overview. I thought it would be good to just share with everyone a snapshot of some things that are going on. It really feels like an eternity ago that we worked on some of these things. The time flies so fast. Literally, you know, certain days and some of the midweeks there, that discussion, you were not going day by day. It was literally hour by hour, 15-minute by 15-minute intervals of changes. And it was just, it was incredibly intense. Things that are coming up that we have been working on that I know we've communicated and had a lot of discussion with legislators and other members of the public. Transportation means of getting folks that don't have transportation methods and getting them tested. I think we'll have a solution in place in the next day or two so we can start broadcasting that and folks that can't make it to the testing site can get tested. We are going to have some more discussion this week about messaging. I think, Leslyn, you really hit it on the head about getting people to stay home. We want to push that more. We want to encourage that more. If you've got to leave, you should only be leaving hopefully for groceries and nothing else. And if you can stay home, we want you to do that. So we're going to work on some new messaging, as well as trying to work with some community partners on different types of messaging, not just factual stuff about public health, but also bringing, you know, getting people in touch with the personal side of everyone to remind folks that we're all going through this together. We're all working through it together. Not there shouldn't be anybody alone as we go through this process. Also internally, you know, this month is a big month for budget prep. Martha and I had a conversation today kind of kicking off some of the budget retreat discussion. And, you know, Kevin and I and Rick will be, I'll be shifting some focus in the budget prep and trying to identify what this year will look like for the rest of the year from a financial perspective and what we can start to think about as we look into next year's budget preparation. You know, as well as that fits into understanding the stimulus package that was adopted that we're trying to draw from. And I think everybody's trying to understand and sift through all the nooks and crannies of that. I'll leave you on two notions, and then I'll be happy to take any questions. One is, you know, it's critically important that everybody continue to talk to each other and look out for each other. It's an active conversation we have here at the EOC, making sure we're checking in with each other and that we don't get too caught up and forgetting about taking care of ourselves and taking care of our families. So we want to continue to push that message out to everyone, making sure that you're taking time for yourself, taking time to check in with your family. You know, shifting from the discussion of social distancing to physical distancing, right? We shouldn't be social distancing or physical distancing doesn't mean we cut ourselves off from each other. And with FaceTime and just call-ins with folks is critically important. We want to continue to stress that in terms of everyone's good mental health and spirits as we go through these challenges. I'll end on one good note that happened today. At 2 o'clock today, I got a call from a colleague of mine, Jack Wheeler, the county administrator in Steuben County, just a little west of us. Jack called me and said, Jason, we have a problem. We have a nursing home that's had unfortunately a few deaths and several employees that have now been infected. The state is going to be dispatching a strike team, but we don't have any sample kits. Can I get 100 sample kits? And I said, send a deputy up here. I talked to Frank real quickly. They sent their deputy here, and by 4 o'clock, we were able to get them 200 sample kits so they could sample and start testing all their staff in the nursing home and the potentially exposed folks. So it was a good partnership. He promised to buy me a few drinks, of course, with the appropriate social distancing when all this clears, but just a good notion of us working with other colleagues across the state to help them overcome challenges that they have. So many thanks to CMC for helping get us the kits quickly, and hopefully they're testing right now as we speak.
Thank you, Jason. Questions? Mike Lane?
Jason, on that last point, I want to really thank you and Frank and your group for doing that. We've been hearing a lot from different counties saying that they got to hold on to all their own stuff, and they aren't looking at it as a statewide kind of thing. I'm glad we are here in Tompkins County.
Thank you, Mike. Annie, and then Martha.
Thank you for that overview, Jason. That was really helpful to find out the timeline of what's going on. And I don't know if that's something – I know that I'll provide a link to people that they can come and watch that. I don't know if that's something that we would want to put out separately just as a little thing for the public to so they know more of what's going on, but just something to think about. I had a couple of questions, or did you want to say something?
So we could do that. We'll send it out to everybody and we'll post it somewhere.
Jason and Annie, you've got to get closer to your microphones.
I said we could definitely send that out and we'll post it for you. We can get it put out.
Thank you. So I had some folks say over the weekend that 211, they had trouble getting through. Does anybody know anything about that?
Sure.
This is Amy. I'll walk in for a second. They did have a little bit of difficulty because there was a spike in call volume, and also during the weekends, 211 goes to another call system. And so thanks to Leslin's message, which was a great thing, there was a little spike there. It's all been taken care of. There was some challenges with that, but we got through it. So 211 is up and active and should be promoted. We're using that for a lot of different resources right now. We're really using that as a county call center. So continue to push that out, please.
Okay, great. Thank you. And trying to see, I think I had one more question here. From a couple of constituents that were posting things online, they wanted to know, since ice cream shops are starting to open, and this also overlaps with Wegmans coffee shop, so some constituents wanted to know, is there any reference to the code for that of like drive up window service, the Wegmans coffee shop, how were they allowed to serve coffee when people could walk around the store, I guess, and drink it? And so I'm just wondering if we have any reference to let people know about what's allowed.
Yeah, so the essential business designation is run by the governor's office, and they are making the determinations on what's considered an essential business. So we're working internally to hopefully in the next day or so get some more guidance out locally for these essential businesses on how to safely operate. The one thing that I would say, though, is that the designation at the state level has to be fairly broad in order to capture as much essential, you know, necessary for sustaining or type businesses. But we really need to reiterate to everyone to please stay home. Ice cream is not necessary for sustaining yourself. And so while I understand that we want to support local businesses, it is really important that in these next few weeks that people stay home except for when they need something that will sustain them. So we're going to get that message out more broadly here in the next couple of days. We're going to get some more guidance out to businesses in order how to operate separately. But it really is about staying home when it's not essential.
So just a follow-up, so is it possible then that ice cream shops might be told at a later date that they can't be open?
So the governor is making the decisions about essential operations. I think what we're going to be looking at is trying to provide guidance to the community so they can make smart decisions about where they go if they have to leave home, and then also guidance to those essential businesses about how to operate as safely as possible if they're going to operate. So that's the approach we're likely going to take versus us telling someone they're not essential or can't operate. Really, the governor has taken the responsibility for that role.
Thank you. Martha, then Henry. Anna, I see you.
Thank you all for that, for all this information. I to follow up on the Wegmans question, is this the coffee shop or the restaurant section? Was it just where they have a coffee along the wall?
It was the coffee shop.
Okay. Is there? I assume the cafe part where you sit and eat, that's been closed. Is that right?
Yes. You're not allowed to sit and eat anywhere.
Okay. If there's maybe when we finish the first round of questions, we'd love to hear an update from you in general, Frank. But I'm interested in can we exceed the governor's recommendations or interpretation of what's essential? I mean, are we locally allowed to go beyond what might be considered the state's guidance?
So one of the executive orders that was a little controversial, but was done for various reasons, is that it pretty much minimized or eliminated the local ability for chief executives to issue executive orders. And that was primarily because there were some communities that were doing things a little disjointed within a community, within a county. So right now, all our executive orders have to be that are to be issued after that point in time have to be sent to the public health department in New York State, and they have to approve the executive order. So I think there's two ways of answering your question. If you wanted to restrict businesses further or issue certificate of occupancy restrictions, you could potentially do it through an executive order, or what most likely would happen is you would do a recommendation, similar to, I think, what Onondaga County just recently did, where they kind of offered a recommendation of shelter in place with movement based on the letter of your last name, I think, on alternate, or your birthday on alternate, or something like that. So I think there's two ways to achieve that, and I know that's something that we're going to be talking about tomorrow morning with our messaging, and as we try to talk about more of staying home, is there anything additional that we would want to do either through an executive order or through a strongly recommended urgency of the public to participate in?
Well, I guess I would put on that list of what stronger recommendations would be masks and gloves for all the people who are deemed essential workers. That is all the grocery workers, all the, whoever else, mail carriers, everybody else. It is a national recommendation. I hope we can reinforce that. I think we should make that as strong as we possibly can. And then on the messaging, there are a couple of things that I've seen at the town of Dryden, the crown jewel of Tompkins County, you're welcome, Mike, has some great lawn signs. It's like, duh, yeah, lawn signs, just like call COVID-19, call 211. Yeah. They've also done a full page in the shopper. Yeah. Which I'm not sure if they're going to do it a second time, but I hope Dominic will take a look at that kind of thing, because we really have to communicate to the folks who aren't on Facebook, who aren't on the web at all, and may only be getting smatterings that are kind of disjointed. So I hope you'll take a look at some of those things.
Yep, absolutely.
Okay, thank you. And we'd love to hear some more from Frank from his point of view, too, when we're done with it.
Okay, got you, Martha. Henry, no, wait, who am I missing?
Henry and then Anna.
Okay. Thank you for all your work that you guys have done. I'd like to talk to you about some vulnerable populations that you may or may not be able to answer. Like, has anybody in the jail who's tested positive?
No.
Okay. Any law enforcement tested positive?
I don't know that we can answer that question.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know that we can answer that question.
Okay, any medical staff?
Again, I would group all the first responders, including medical staff, that if they have been or they have potentially been exposed, they've gone through their proper protocols of being isolated or quarantined, depending on their circumstances.
Okay, I was also going to send you, and I'll probably still send it around, but how the last couple of days has been a couple of articles about Black Americans who initially thought that they were immune to the coronavirus, in fact, have had alarming rates of coronavirus, in fact, maybe double the rates of other people. And I was wondering, is there a concern in our county for African Americans with coronavirus?
Yeah, we've been seeing those same reports very particularly in the last few days in some of the larger metropolitan areas. obviously our numbers are still very low, and right. there wouldn't be any conclusions to draw from our local numbers about that. But certainly we are concerned at the data that we're seeing from some of the metropolitan areas, and we definitely need to be thinking about how we can message most effectively to our African American populations about this, because we want them to be getting the same messaging that everyone is at risk, and that there may be some need for them to take additional precaution.
Okay. And also my last question is, when we eventually come out of lockdown, and Jason may be addressed a little bit, is will it be on a state level? Will it be on a county level? How will that exactly work, since everyone's at different rates?
I think based on the way the governor's approached this, you know, he's taken the New York pause approach. I would imagine when the governor is in a position and the guidance he's been receiving is suggesting that they can, you know, lift off the New York pause, they'll do it on a statewide basis. And we would probably, you know, and I would imagine that would be followed by guidance by their public health department, the state public health department, and we would follow that guidance. Nonetheless, it brings up a question about can counties or other communities continue to issue executive orders that are more restrictive. That may be a point of discussion that takes place at that time. But my guess is that when the governor is ready to, you know, based on the advice that he's being given from the medical professionals and the public health department, he will lift the New York pause, or more likely probably some gradual, my guess would be some gradual loosening of the restrictions, but not all at once. I think that's a point of discussion that we would have, that the legislature would want to have at that time.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Henry. Anna? Anna, you're muted. Go ahead.
A few questions. One, Frank, I want to know if you could give us an update on antibody testing.
Yeah, so the governor talked about that today, and they are trying to work on making that available. I think I heard Dr. Zucker say their focus is on IgM, which is finding out if you have had the disease, not whether you currently have it. So it would become a tool for us to know about herd immunity, essentially. So are there people in the community that have been exposed and have developed antibodies that might not be susceptible in a second round of this? It's those antibodies are essentially an effective tool similar to a vaccine, right? So the idea is we want to get as many people in the population immune to contracting the disease, so that way the social distancing mechanisms that we're using now might not be as necessary in a second round of this particular strain of coronavirus.
And do you know from all the public health research coming out that you might have access to that they've confirmed that it's not something that can be contracted twice, is this something like the flu, more that we have growing expectation that it'll be something like seasonality? We'll have a regular vaccine that may or may not be a good match. Do you have a sense of where that's going?
Yeah, I don't. Obviously, we're doing our best to try to keep up with the science, but we're in the midst of response as well. So I'm reading as much as I can. I do think it's still fairly inconclusive. The disease has only been with us for less than 6 months, as we understand it now. So making wide sweeping statements about how it's reacting in humans, I don't think the science or data is there yet. Obviously, there's people much smarter than me working on this, and I'm sure as soon as it's conclusive, we'll know that for sure.
One last question. You mentioned, staying home, not going to, restaurants if you don't need to, or ice cream shops. One statement I wanted to make for people who want to support businesses right now, getting gift cards, you know, really highly encouraging that is to support them if they want, because they can be used later. There was an article that came out, I think it was in the New York Times, came out also in the, I think it was the Ithaca Journal, Ithaca Times today, about the infection rate or like food not being highly contagious or contaminated, not at high risk of spreading COVID-19. Have you read that? Are we countering that message or aligned with it?
Yeah, and I wish I knew the fine detail of that. I mean, I believe I understand that, you know, our digestive system will take care of it for us. It's the question on whether you can be exposed to it from the surface contact, right, during the process of eating. I don't know the answer to that. I would encourage folks to, you know, take whatever precautions that they feel they need to, but ultimately our own hands are our own worst enemy in this, and so washing often is still really important. And I think we've left that behind a little bit as we've gotten into these dramatic social distancing steps and talking about masks and testing and all of that. Still the single best thing that folks need to be doing is washing their hands often. Because besides getting infected from a sick person or someone that's, you know, transmitting it to you, that surface contact is still the best way for you to transmit it to yourself. And so washing hands often and frequently and washing commonly touched surfaces, those messages we were saying all the way back at the beginning still hold true today.
Thank you, Frank.
Thank you. Shauna?
Hi, Farron. Can you tell us, have you seen an increase in testing from those that believe they were exposed at Wegmans on Monday and today?
Yeah, so yesterday through the testing site, there was 455 people that came through. Our single largest day prior to that was under 200. So we obviously saw a huge influx yesterday. We have added criteria. The available criteria for testing has shifted a little bit. We are now recommending that anyone that is a close contact to a known case get tested, whether they are symptomatic or not. And that was a shift that occurred over the weekend for us, which is why we recommended that anyone that had contact with the coffee shop go and get tested, whether they are symptomatic or not. The one thing I want to share about that that's important for the public to understand is that if you are not symptomatic, you are likely to test negative. That doesn't mean that you might not test positive the next day or the day after. And we have to remember that the incubation period is between 2 and 14 days. So if you have been exposed to a known case, even if you go and get tested and you come back negative, we still want you to quarantine for the 14 days from the point of exposure to that known individual to make sure that you don't develop symptoms. Mm-hmm. And if you were to develop symptoms, you should go get retested again.
Okay. And then my second question is, what is the turnaround time that you're seeing for the tests that are being done?
Sure. So, you know, we always want to be careful about promising turnaround times, but it's been roughly 2 days. So if you know, kind of follow the numbers since the large drive-thru opened on Mondays and Tuesdays, we're not getting a lot of results back because Saturday and Sunday the drive-thru isn't open. But on Wednesday of this week, we're expecting to see a large number of results come back because of Monday's influx. So it has been about 2 days, but understand as more tests are done, labs have, you know, more tests need to be run. It takes a little bit longer. As other sites come up for sampling, they're all going to a, you know, limited number of labs, and that could affect times. So I don't want folks to you know, get set that, oh, it's going to be 2 days from here on out. It is still changing every day, just like everything else. But right now it's about 2 days.
Thank you.
Thank you. Frank, is there anything else you want to add? To share with us?
Sure. I'm certainly happy to answer any other questions that you might have. One thing I do want to share, on Friday, Cuyahoga Health Systems and myself convened a meeting of the six counties that are contiguous to us, the public health directors, to talk about getting, promoting access to the drive-through clinic here to make this more of a regional approach, because we certainly recognize that my colleagues in the counties around us do not have the same access to testing that we do. I met again with them on Monday, shared our messaging, and they are all going to begin sharing messaging in their community that their folks can come to our drive-through. So we are trying to make it as available as possible. And just to answer a question before it's asked, their first question is, well, why can't you set these up in our counties for our folks? And the reason for that is the work that Cuyahoga Health System has done to put this together, it isn't easily movable, in that in order to achieve the efficiencies that they have and the turnaround times for the sampling, there's a very intricate process that happens all day long while the site is open to get samples moved to our lab folks here locally to get processed and then get sent off-site for the results to get processed. So it's not easy to just set that up anywhere, and particularly in smaller settings because of the efficiencies as well as the burn rate of PPE. In this large-scale site, we're able to have many more tests done with a single set of PPE than we would if you set up smaller ones in different areas.
All right. Martha, you have a question?
Yes, thanks for explaining that, Frank. That's very helpful to know. I was wondering, just a statement about sort of reinforcing the idea that everybody's anxious about when can we reopen, when can we relax the stay-at-home guidance. I think as painful as it is, I think we should all remember that the tighter we keep these restrictions on, the more complete and quicker the recovery, you know, that we'll accomplish. And if we kind of, if we loosen it back up again, we'll just have whack-a-mole everywhere else where, like, we're probably going to get around the country. So it's really important to just stay with these painful but important guidelines. Can you tell us first off, on the as you change the testing criteria? I know that'll be, you know, top of your message line, and I hope well publicized on the website, et cetera. How's CMC, how's Cougar Medical doing, and for PPE, you know, for personnel, for beds, that sort of thing? And do you know whether they're sending equipment or staff downstate?
Yeah, that's a great question, Martha, and I can't speak more highly of Cuyahoga Health Systems. Dr. Salone and his team have been amazing throughout all of this, standing up the testing as quickly and as effectively as they have. They've actually taken over the calling responsibility after somebody goes through the drive-through to make the daily calls. They're doing that under my direction on behalf of the health department, but it's lifted the burden so that our nurses can focus on the contact investigations that they need to do. So they have been amazing partners throughout this. They have gone above and beyond, quite frankly, what I would have expected a health system to do in a situation like this. So they deserve all of the credit for making that happen. I do know that tomorrow they have a team of 60 staff. I'm sure you've all have heard at least some of this by now, that we'll be heading to New York City to Presbyterian Hospital for 30 days. They're going to be taking over a COVID-19 ward for that 30 days. And so Cayuga Health is not only standing up to help us here locally, but they've pulled their team together and are now heading into the epicenter to help New York City as well.
Did you say 60 or 16 staff?
60.
Wow.
That's incredible. And are they doing okay for PPE?
Yeah. Dr. Stallone has reported that they still have adequate PPE. They are working with volunteers at Bartles Hall to make more PPE. It's really been amazing to see what's been happening. But right now, CMC tells us that they are okay.
That's great. I'm really grateful that they're sending folks downstate. That's just what that's perfect. Thank you.
Mike Sigler. And you disappeared.
Sorry about that. Frank, I guess I think it's great that CMC is sending these folks down. My question is, how will they return? I mean, once they're down there, say they do the 2 weeks down there, when they come back up here, they're going to have to self-quarantine, right, for 14 days. They're not going to be able to work in the hospital, or are they? I don't know.
Yeah, so that's a really good question, Mike. That once they return, assuming the situation is still what it is, they would need to quarantine. But the essential workers, there is different guidance for them as to what quarantine means. And we went through this with the Wegmans situation as well. So generally, for the general population, if you are exposed to a known case of COVID-19, you're to quarantine for 14 days post that exposure. For healthcare workers, they are supposed to do the same quarantine except for being able to go to work. And in order to make sure that there are additional protections in place, there's criteria that have to be met. First, they can't be symptomatic, of course. Anyone that's symptomatic is in isolation and can't go anywhere. But they also have to have a temperature check at the beginning of their shift before starting. They would have to have a temperature check every 12 hours if they were working more than a 12-hour shift. They have to wear appropriate PPE when around any other people, meaning a mask and gloves. And so they would still be able to work in those situations if called upon. I would imagine after working 30 days in New York City, they're going to need a two-week break when they get back. So they'll likely be staying home. But if we were in a situation where they were needed to help us care for people in Tompkins County, they would be able to work with additional precautions.
Okay. Thank you, Frank. Deborah, and then Henry.
Yeah, thank you, Leslyn. Thank you, Frank and Jason, for everything you've done and this great briefing. I'm curious about symptoms of this disease. I mean, you read so much about asymptomatic people being contagious and these different symptoms that one might have. Are there any symptoms that appear in every single case, or is it somewhat idiosyncratic?
Yeah, there's not any single symptom that appears in every single case. So there are folks that have had just a cough, some that have just had a fever, you know, some that have just had the shortness of breath. Diarrhea is starting to become, a symptom that we're looking for. But there is no, this is definitely COVID-19, right? There's a series of different types of symptoms, and all of them need to be treated the same way, that if you have them, you need to isolate yourself, seek testing to confirm if you do or don't, but most important, isolate yourself from others.
Thank you.
Henry?
Yes, Frank, you mentioned that healthcare workers, and also you said the Wegmans employee comes under different roles. What's the rules for the Wegmans employee? Is that for all essential workers?
Yeah, my apologies. I did shift back into healthcare workers. It is for all essential employees. So if you are working at an essential business and you are an employee of that, you would, if you are exposed, potentially like a Wegmans worker was, they could still continue to work with the same precautions, temperatures being taken before shift, masks needing to be worn. That is if you were exposed to the individual.
Okay.
Okay, Martha, then Mike Sigler.
Thanks for another shot here. So back to the Wegmans. What would you say about, I don't know if we can mandate, but I'd really love to see grocery workers all wearing masks. I picked up groceries at Wegmans on Sunday, did the curbside thing, and I didn't see any of them wearing masks. And then I got home and read this alert that we had one of their employees test positive. Is there any reason we cannot direct grocery store employees to grocery stores to provide masks for their employees and ask them to wear them all the time?
Yeah, I think we've covered a bit of our approach with this, is where we are going to be looking in the next day or so to provide more guidance to employers about what we're recommending, and it will likely be a bit broader than the minimum. The mandating piece goes back to the executive order situation that Jason was talking about, and getting direction or approval from the governor's office for those type of situations. Yeah, and then the last piece of that is there aren't just masks sitting around that we can give to people either. So, I think a lot of these organizations are already working to try to provide masks, but they have to find them and make them available. So there's still a prioritization of who's getting them. And in this instance, we would want people that were a contact of a known case to be the first priority to get masks over everybody having them, if it meant we would run out quicker.
Okay, thanks for whatever you can do on that. On the test, on our reports on the health department website, I'm glad you're testing from other, you're going to push that out for other counties, for their residents to come in. How's that going to show up on our daily statistics? Are you going to break those numbers down?
Yeah, the only thing that we're reporting are Tompkins County residents. So we've had non-Tompkins County residents coming for quite some time, even back in the Kraft Road site before the large one at the mall was open, and those numbers always get pulled out. So all we are reporting are Tompkins County residents.
So that's for the total number tested and the pending results, all of that?
Correct. Everything that's on our website is Tompkins County residents only.
Okay, and just one more thing. I'm sure you've heard about the symptom of loss of the sense of smell and the sense of taste. So that's another something else that you're looking for with people?
Yeah, that has become a bit more common. Yep.
Okay.
I would also share on the symptomology, one thing that we're seeing is that people will have symptoms early. They'll start to feel a little bit better, and then they'll get sicker again. That's starting to become fairly common with the folks that we're following here in our cases.
All right. Thank you again for everything.
Thank you. How about we get to last comments here, Annie and Rich?
Thank you, Frank. My last comment is just a follow-up on what Martha was saying. And so in my head, a minimal requirement that I would like is that for businesses to allow employees to wear masks, because I've been hearing that all over the county, that some employees are, including Wegmans until last week, did not allow their employees to wear masks.
Sure. And just to be fair to them, up until Friday, when the CDC changed their recommendation, we were not recommending that people wear masks just generally, mainly because of the supply concerns associated with that. And that only shifted on Friday when the CDC recommendation changed. So I'm hoping that over the next few days, we'll start to see those type of challenges go away, because the recommendation is now, if you can't maintain 6 feet of separation, to wear a face covering.
Thank you. Rich?
Mike Sigler. Yeah, I think Mike Sigler is in line, too. He might have been ahead of me, but...
Yes, he is.
But I'll jump in anyway, Mike, with your permission. I just wanted to mention the Ithaca Voice had an article about the healthcare workers going to New York City. They're going to be leaving by bus tomorrow morning, I believe, at 8:30 from the hospital and traveling through the city of Ithaca and up State Street. And they were saying if you were inclined to, at a safe distance, wave these people off, it would be a nice thing to do.
That's correct, Rich. I was going to mention it. So they're coming down, going down Green Street and up 79 Way. So they certainly are encouraging people to, you know, give them a joyous and positive energy send-off if you are around and can line the streets and, you know, just give them a shout-out. Go ahead, Mike Sigler.
My question is actually, thank you, Frank, for all the information. My next question is actually for the county administrator. Is he still there? I was just wondering, I don't want to take you too far off topic, but as, Jason, as people get cooped up more, some of the social things that we deal with that are pretty acute normally, I'm going to imagine are going to become even more so. I'm just wondering how we're dealing with topics not related to COVID ID that the county has to do all the time anyway. Like some of the things in DSS are critical every day with or without the virus. So like child welfare and things like that. I'm just wondering how our team is kind of holding up with all that other stuff that we're not like hearing about on a daily basis.
Well, imagine this, you know, imagine this, that in literally 48 hours, you're given the directive that you have to change everything you do the way you've done it for decades, and it has to happen with very little guidance. And that is essentially what they had to do. I would say, you know, all our departments have done a remarkable job, DSS particularly, in adjusting to, you know, non-essential folks or telework options. A lot of the, and mental health is another one that I think has made remarkable. Both those departments have made remarkable adjustments in that they've shifted to telecounseling and telemedicine that, under normal circumstances for a variety of reasons would take months to implement. You know, they did it in a relatively, I mean, you know, short period of time. A lot of what's allowed that to happen is changes in the regulatory environment, which has allowed no longer in-person contact to take place, whether it's with DSS or whether it's with mental health, where they can do some of this remotely and it's allowed it to be done remotely. And I'll say this, it's evolving probably every day or every week. They're doing checks. I know some of the updates I've sent out is we're talking to departments weekly about what's going on in their world. And a lot of this is adapting to what's happening around them. We started out doing it this way. We're going to be changing to it this way because we're noticing we're getting better feedback, better response. So, Child Protective Services, there's, you know, a lot of different elements of DSS, but they're continuing to provide the services. They're doing it, you know, remotely. They're doing it over the phone. If they're doing in-person contacts, they're keeping distances. They're just doing it in different ways. And I think they're still getting positive results. Probation is another example. Yeah, where they have to have in-person contact and check-ins on people and how they're going about it. Some general services have been suspended temporarily the day reporting has been shut down and hasn't been opened up again. But for the most part, a lot of those essential court mandated services are continuing. They're just doing it differently. And, you know, the reason of having the planning team check in everything once a week with everybody is to say, all right, do we need to have new adjustments? Are there new things that need to be put in place? And if so, what resources do we need to make those adjustments and why? So it's a constant evolving check-in with the departments about the services they're providing. If there's something specific, if I can't answer it, I can definitely get back to you on it. Yeah, they've been very resilient. It's been impressive to see the changes. I think one of the questions we've talked about now is that when all of this calms down a little bit and the question of what regulations were loosened or undone to allow this to happen, there's going to be an after action review on a lot of these things to say, do we need to go back to the old style or not? Because, you know, I think you're finding that some areas of service delivery are finding improved connectivity and improved performance because of the relaxing of some of those regulatory regulations in the regulatory environment. So it'd be interesting to see you know, when you get back to normal, whatever that is, if they ramp back up on the regulatory environment or not.
All right. Thanks, Jason. I just didn't know how, like, things like child protective services could even be done. So thank you.
I might get back to you more in detail as to what they're doing exactly. They're doing it.
All right. Thanks.
Well, I hope that when we get past this that we don't stick with only Zoom meetings, because I want to be able to look people in the eye, not in the little box. That is not one of the things I would recommend continuing. Martha, Anna, and folks, I know this is our chance, but looking at the time as well. Go ahead, Martha.
I know. Just a quick one. Just given all of that, just a huge shout out to the ITS department. You know, it isn't just kind of magic. We wave our boom. We have Zoom and everything else. It's really astonishing.
Greg gives a thumbs up.
And we have a small ITS department. I can sort of smell a budget request coming, Jason. I don't know.
Yeah.
So thanks to Greg and your whole team. Thanks.
Thank you. Anna?
Yeah, I'm mute.
Anna, you're waving your hand and doing something funky. We got you.
Just saying, I just realized that you guys all see me sitting sideways, but it's because I have a big screen in front of me as a legally blind person. Like, this is easier for me to see. So, yes, I'm paying attention over here. And I was just realizing, too, Jason, that we can sort of tell the extent of how hard you guys are working by the length of your beard.
Everything.
So I just wanted to give a shout-out to everybody at the EOC. You can tell how hard they're all working.
Amy's beard.
Yeah, Amy.
Well, they made it. It's gotten grayer.
I think I see that. I'm not sure I saw any gray when you first were hired 2 years ago. We've done a number on you. So thank you so much. I had one question actually about childcare. I know, you guys have been supporting them, and the CDC Child Development Council did put out a notification about fundraisers that they've been doing, that they've reopened. I think two centers have reopened for essential care workers. Can you describe a little bit about what's going on with childcare?
Again, folks, speak up a little bit. Use the microphones.
I'm going to have Jay talk about this.
Oh, we get to see Jay's beard. Hey!
Hey, this year we'll do for you. But, yeah, we've been in contact with Sue Dale Hall from the Child Development Council. They're having a hard time trying to drum up business. They're down to two centers that have reopened. I think one has 13 students there, and another one has just a few out at the Cottington Road Center. So, yeah, they do have funding. They're going for more funding, so they do have scholarships available. But I think with a lot of the registered care facilities already open or that have stayed open, and then with everyone taking our good advice and staying home, that there's already child care available there. So there's just not that demand that we thought. You know, there's 115 spaces that we made eligible for students to be able to go there, but there's just not that demand.
And is it available just to families who have parents who are working in essential services? Is it open for everyone? I'd heard mixed.
As of right now, it's just for essential workers. So under that definition, any of those parents would be eligible for their children to go there.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you all very much. Thank you for all the information. One of the things that I always pride myself, and I know we all do, is that Tompkins County continues to be a leader in whatever it is that we do. Shauna and I were just talking this afternoon. Where did she go? There. On, you know, how other counties are looking to us, and you've heard some of that today. We may look at the TV news and think that there are wonderful things happening in other counties, and that's not necessarily true. behind the scenes, it's not really the case. And so we are offering services, we're offering equipment, we're, you know, sending people along to support. Folks are asking, what messaging are you putting out? We have sent our messaging to other counties that they can use. What we have been doing a while ago, people are now ramping up to get done. So major kudos to our EOC, to the folks who are there, and to all of you, all of us as legislators in the community, for pushing some of the questions and concerns that help fuel some of the actions that are being taken by our EOC. So thanks, everyone. I don't have a beard. I'm so thankful for that. I shave every day, Glenn. So I don't have a Jason-looking type beard. But really, I'm very, very thankful for all the work that we're doing and continuing to, you know, sort of be a leader in so much of it. Is there anything else from folks in the EOC, communications folks, Jason, Frank, anything else before I move on to Jonathan and Rick?
No. The only thing I'd like to just say is you know, this group and the whole team, even though not everyone here, have done a phenomenal and a remarkable job. You know, we went through a 30-day kind of span of it. It doesn't cover the 6 weeks prior that the public health nurses have been working at quarantine certain persons under investigation during that process. You know, we talked a little bit about the hours work, but, you know, working here, you know, a lot of it has been nonstop. It's, you know, it's 12, 14-hour days, and when you're not here, you're still thinking about it. It goes home with you. You can't leave it here. And then next day it starts, and a whole new day starts. So the level of commitment that not only the members here have shown, the leadership they've shown, the folks that are working remotely, the PIO team and planning team, all have been absolutely remarkable. A lot of them working in different jobs they've never worked in before and supporting the effort. So my hats go off to all of them, and I couldn't be happier to work with them. They are truly committed. They find solutions. They work with partners, and there's never an issue of, no, we can't do that. It's just figuring out how to get it done, and I think we're fortunate to have that group. So I just want to thank them. I know everybody feels the same way. It's a very good group.
Don't hear anything. No, get closer. Well, thank you very much, Jason. I see Lisa up there as well. Shout out to you, to Lisa, for everything you're doing as part of holding up regular daily operations down. Much appreciated. Everything's from you all working through the issues of furloughs and, you know, who's essential, who, you know, does have to come in, the coops, the all of it. Still pushing policies. And I know you also, you know, haven't been feeling too well, so we're really thankful to you and the rest of the workforce for continuing the services of county government. We really do appreciate it. So thank you all. Before we take a break, 15 minutes before a break, see, I remember, let's move on to our county attorney and finance director, Jonathan.
Can
you tell us?
Can people hear me?
Loud and clear.
Good. So Leslin had asked me to talk a little bit about our enforcement with regard to COVID-19. There have apparently been several questions on that. So, you know, as you all know, there have been quite a few executive orders by the governor. Some of them we all know well, about separation, distances and businesses not being open that are not critical, et cetera. Others are a little, I mean, there are quite a few. But the question does come up, of course, how are we enforcing that? Who is enforcing that, et cetera? So to give a little background, there are certain things that are enforced by the state and certain things that are enforced by the county, which includes different agencies within the county. The most typical thing that is enforced by the state, or what is clearly enforced by the state, are labor issues. For example, an employee is not getting sick leave or believes, or is being treated as a critical employee and believes that he or she is not a critical employee. So when we get the complaints related to labor, those sort of things, we refer them to the state. And there is a state number, et cetera, for those kind of complaints to be referred to. other complaints, for example, business being open in Tompkins County, which shouldn't be open, or people think shouldn't be open, or business, for example, not practicing appropriate procedures for keeping employees and guests safe, for example, not having separation distances and that sort of thing. So basically, complaints by people can go to two areas. One, there's a state number set up for people to complain to or to bring concerns to. And interestingly, the state screens those but then sends them back to the county to do whatever enforcement. And we have given the state, the people at the county, and the numbers to contact, which is, by the way, in our environmental health division. So those are the people who would be contacted when citizens complain to the state. Also,
Jonathan, can you repeat that? Who are they?
They are people who work in the administrative part of our environmental health department, which is within public health.
So that's
the area headed by Liz Cameron, Skip Parr, Adriel Shea work there. And they're essentially the people who provide the most guidance in that department. They're not actually the contact people. The contact people are the administrative people there. But those are for the state to contact, not for the general public. So if people complain to the state will do an initial view to see if it's a credible complaint, and then they will contact us, and we've given them the people at environmental health to contact. The other way complaints come in or concerns is directly to the county. Those are directed, and people should know they should contact the health department, just at the general health department number. That's the best place. If they contacted, for example, administration would refer them to the health department. So if people have concerns regarding business, for example, that they feel that they are threatened in a way that may make them more likely to get COVID-19 or be exposed to it, the public health department would be the appropriate county agency to contact. So then if you kind of take it through, so we would get complaints or concerns, and they would either come from members of the public or from the state. What we would do, and by we, I mean our environmental health department primarily, is to check and see the validity of those claims. Let's say, for example, a business which is not critical is open. They would initially do an initial investigation to see if that's correct or not. Now, of course, some people may not realize what is critical and what is not. There are a few things which the governor has identified as definitely not critical, for example, a hair salon. But many things are in a more gray area. And like Frank had said before, it's for the state to determine what's critical and what's not. So there are things that people might think are not critical, which are. One of the first things they do is do an initial investigation. Then they would, if they think there's some viability to it, or even unable to determine, they would speak with the business. And if they feel that the business is doing something that they shouldn't do, they would warn them and tell them they shouldn't do that. Now, almost all the time, that is going to take care of the problem. But in the event it doesn't, they would take the second step, which, and this, I'd say contact the sheriff, but what they would really do is contact 911 in order for them to assign the appropriate law enforcement agency, which may often be the sheriff, but not necessarily, depending on where it is. And the first step that the law enforcement agency would do is basically go out there and just talk to the business, advise them that, you know, this is the rules and they should comply. They wouldn't take any real enforcement action at that point. They're just, you know, we feel that, you know, the sheriff coming out and telling you to close down is probably going to result in you closing down in the event that the health department doing that didn't. Only in this case where that didn't happen would we then pursue an order from the public health director, which is, you know, I don't have to get into the sections of the health law, et cetera, and then send law enforcement to actually enforce that order, which could include fines and penalties. We don't expect really to ever get there. It's just the process that we follow in order to, you know, make businesses and those know the seriousness of the, you know, of the potential threat. And so we all kind of had this going even before we got the guidance from the state, but now that the state has established a hotline and stuff, so we're coordinating with them. And for the most part, it's worked out. We haven't really had any major incidents. We've certainly had complaints and concerns. And that's all. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
So one of the things that I want to find out, and maybe this is for our communications folks, is how do we get the information to the public on the number they're supposed to call? Is that some board messaging somewhere? How do we get that information out?
Yeah, I actually talked with Frank about that today, and we will get something out that'll make it easier for the public to know who to contact. Oh, there is one thing I didn't mention, which I probably should, but it's a little complicated. And the governor has also given local code enforcement officers power to remediate certain violations, including businesses being open and businesses that have too many people in them more than they are supposed to physically. In these cases, the health department kind of has to use their judgment as to whether it would be helpful or not to incorporate the local code enforcement officer. In some cases it would be, in some cases it wouldn't necessarily be. They have to use their judgment in each case as to whether that might be helpful or not. So, and that's sort of an issue in that the governor has given the responsibility to enforcement to kind of a whole bunch of different people without really, and thus we kind of have to work out for ourselves who's going to do what.
All right. Thank you, Jonathan. Questions? Martha.
Thank you, Jonathan. So by any chance, do you happen to have the health department number and the state hotline number right now so we can just kind of put them out there right now?
Frank is listening. He could give it to you.
Okay.
I mean, I don't have it off the top of my head. I could get most of the numbers, but I might get one wrong and then I mess everybody up.
Okay.
Yeah,
I have another question, but Frank's about to answer, I think.
Yeah, well, we'll get the state number. We're working on it while I answer. The health department number for environmental health is 274-6688.
Okay, so individuals can call that number if they have a complaint about a business that they think is not complying. Is that the idea?
Correct.
And what about if they see a neighbor or a group at a park or, you know, see other residents doing things that they feel are not compliant? Is there any recourse? What do they do?
I think we would recommend the state number for that, just because they're going to be triaging it against the executive orders that exist at that moment. And that'll be kind of the guidance that then makes its way down to us. Because, you know, we're trying to keep up with the executive orders and who's essential and what activities are okay and which aren't. But they have folks that are well versed in it that can kind of make those determinations. and then get that back to us. We have been asking our local elected officials when we talk to them each week that, you know, if they're hearing from constituents or they're seeing, you know, that there are different activities that are causing groups to congregate, like the basketball hoops or the skate park, those kind of things, that they might have to take one-off actions to address those. And I think to date they've been pretty responsive in trying to address those things. A lot of this is personal responsibility, and we don't want neighbors getting in arguments, you know, over these kind of things. So calling the state number is probably the best first step.
I agree with that.
I can give you the state number, by the way, if that helps.
Okay, yeah, let me just I agree with that. I think that, I mean, things like the college town parties that were happening just before the students left, and then it may take too long to actually call the state to go through that process, then the party, you know, the event has passed.
Yeah, we're still hearing about many of those things, and when we do, we are reaching out to who might be the appropriate party, whether it's a local elected leader that might reach out, or in those instances, Cornell did some very specific messaging out. So we are hearing of those things, and we're trying to work with the appropriate community partners. Again, as Jonathan mentioned, we don't want this to have to be an enforcement thing. We'd prefer it be an education thing. And to date, most times when we've made a call or we've reached out and explained why it's not good, people have been responsive and doing the right thing.
I just want, thank you. Just one other quick thing.
Wait, Jonathan, I would really like that number.
Oh, yeah.
I think Tom just emailed it out to everybody.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
All right. And I heard from a local landlord that he's hearing that students who had been sent out of town but have leases through July are starting to talk about coming back, that I guess they'd rather be, you know, socially isolated up here instead of at their parents' house. I'm maybe being a bit judgmental there, but maybe. Is there a concern there? Is there anything, you know, if a landlord would prefer that they don't come back, is there anything there, either that the county can do or that somebody should do?
I don't think there's anything we can do. I mean, if there's a private contract for a lease or a private contract between two people for a lease, they have the right to go back and execute that. Obviously, I don't think the message changes whether they're from the area or whether finishing out a lease, it's, you know, stay home. And so to that extent, as long as they can do that, you know, there's nothing that we can do to prevent them from coming back into, you know, a contract that they've entered into. It still doesn't mean that they have any lesser obligation to commit to staying home and minimizing, you know, non-essential travel.
Can you say that number out loud since this is being recorded?
All right, we'll get it. Yeah.
Sure. Can you hear me now? Am I on?
Yes.
Number is 1-833-789-0470.
And this is,
and
if
also
have a complaint, they can about a business being open, or if they're an employee and they think they're non-essential but they're being considered essential, they can call this number, correct?
Right. Now, I'm sure that number will refer them, the employee things, to the State Department of Labor. So if that's your complaint, you should may want to maybe quicker just to go to the State Department of Labor, which also has a number, but I don't have it available. But if it's a labor complaint, you could definitely call this number, but it's probably easier and faster and more direct to call the State Department of Labor. And if you go to their website, you'll see their number to call them for the such things.
Okay, I want to recognize that Annie has her hand raised. She's had her hand raised. Now, before we go any further, and before we start putting out information that might be not particularly accurate, I heard Frank say that they are going to be getting some information out to us, some guidance, and here's the number to call if you have A, B, C, or D complaints. So if we can be patient, we'll get that so we don't put out a number and say call,
you know, if you have a complaint with things that may not be what folks should be calling about. Please, let's try to hold off and get that information. In the meantime, Frank, can you please repeat the environmental health number for folks to call locally for other concerns?
Sure, it's 607-274-6688.
88. Correct. Thank you. Annie?
Yes, thank you. So that was very helpful, Jonathan. And so Buttercup and I were wondering about if we could have, at least for me as a legislator, to have maybe a rough draft before that goes out to the public. And I wouldn't post it, but just to try and answer a little bit of, because some of us have had questions from the public. And then, of course, if we can get information right before that goes out or when that goes out to the public, and I guess that would be Dominic. So thank you.
Okay. Depends on who Buttercup is.
Thank you. Any other questions for Jonathan? Jonathan, thank you for that.
Sure.
And I had sent the information that came from the state to all legislators. Did anybody not get it? Okay.
Yeah, so that thing which came from the state, which I assume is what you forwarded, does have the state number on it.
Right. Anything else from you, Jonathan?
Nothing, no.
No one else suing us for anything?
That's not true. But...
Oh, Jonathan. All right.
But courts are closed, at least, except for emergency things. Well, I should add, just so people know, that the state court system has set up a way to have court in cases of emergency, which actually includes two offices that are at DSS where people can phone in remotely.
That's good information to have.
Of course, those will only be for things that the state deems urgent to have during this period of when court is otherwise closed.
Okay. Thank you for sharing that. Appreciate it. All right. Any other questions to Jonathan before I move on to Rick and before we take a break? No, thank you. Rick, do you have anything for us? How are you doing?
I'm doing well, and so is finance. We just went.
Well, that's a good thing.
That's a very good thing. And we are open for business, and we have been through this whole ordeal so far, even though business is not as usual. A lot less public coming to us, especially since the doors were locked at the beginning of the week. But we do have. But we did have customers last week, and we still have customers, both county departments and the outside public, coming to us by appointment. And we do deal with them on a one-on-one basis that way. We have been up and running and trying to do the best we can. Working on payroll right now tonight with a couple staff members. That's going well. So we're right on track with payroll. The last one was a lot more difficult 2 weeks ago. But as far as checks going out the door, revenues coming in, all that is pretty much normal here for us. It's hard on staff because they feel the stress of, being the essential worker and having to be here where a lot of other people are not. But we rotate our staff here. At first, when we first started, we were probably only about two or three people had the capability of working at home. That quickly changed when this hit us 3 weeks ago or so, and now just about every employee has the capability of being able to work at home if it lends itself to that. So on any given day, about 50 or 60% of our staff are home and working at home. We still have two vacancies here, which was very difficult to go through the audit season. Still trying to fill those vacancies. That's not going real well, of course, due to the circumstance. We had another person who is our secondary payroll person who had to be out for a couple weeks due to a personal situation, and she's out on leave for a while. So we're running real slim on the payroll front. We're running very slim on the consortium bookkeeping front. We don't have a very deep staff to keep up with that, but we are keeping up with it. And I think we're doing, in light of the situation, we're doing about as well as could be expected. And I'd like to say that we're on track with the county audit, but we're not. We fell off the rails about 2 weeks ago, and we're working right now on a consortium audit. That's still on schedule, and it looks like we can keep that on track. The county audit, I explained to our auditors 2 weeks ago that we were probably about 2 or 3 weeks behind. We tried to get some relief from them to postpone it, to push it back. We don't know if the state's going to relax their guidelines to allow us to submit our annual report any later than normal. Of course, we haven't heard anything effective from the state one way or the other on that. But the auditors were not too flexible. They were only able to push us back 1 week. So instead of starting the field audit on April 16th, we'll be starting it on April 23rd. But I think it's going to be a rough haul because we're still about, I don't really know, 2 or 3 weeks behind at least in where we should be for audit preparation. Like I said, the staff are doing well. It is difficult interacting with staff a lot of times. When half of us are working at home, half of us are working at the office, that one primary person that you need to be working with that day is not available to work on a project, so you have to put it off a day. So, but it does make it better now that most of them can Zoom and we can work at home a little bit. Of course, the public interaction, as far as that element of it on the Treasury side, we can only do the best that we can. We're still receiving payments by mail. People still have the ability to pay payments online. And, of course, we still meet them and greet them by appointment when they need to come here to the facility. I guess the best news was that I was on grand jury duty starting March 13th, and this has been easy for me because I haven't had to go. So I'm filling my commitment by not going because of the reduced schedule, as Jonathan explained, for the court hours. But we're trying as hard as we can to keep our shop open, running, and effective. And I just commend my staff for doing the job that they are doing under these hard times.
And, thank you.
And I appreciate them so much for what they've been working through. And everyone is healthy. Everyone so far. So we have one person out right now for health-related reasons, but it's not COVID-19. And so I'm just thankful that so far so good.
Well, thank you, Rick. You know, no, it is unusual times, and we just get it. You know, things will start falling into place. Mike Lane?
Hi, Rick. Your report certainly underscores how important our financial services are here in the county, as well as other places. The big gorilla in the room, for me at least, is sales tax. And what's going to happen this quarter, I know you don't know, but are we beginning to think about how we're going to look at sales tax projections if they come in way under expectations? Also, I would assume that the casino revenues could likely be hit because of fewer people being able to go to the casinos. Have you or your association begun talking about that at all?
Everybody's asking the same questions. How bad will it be? But it's still too early to tell from receipts just how bad it is. Of course, we have receipts. I had planned to share them with you tonight. They are not available yet. We're so far behind on recording 2020 revenues that we don't have January or February sales tax information to share with you yet. I plan on bringing that to you at the next meeting. Hopefully, I can get caught up. By that time, we will probably have March, so we'll have one whole quarter to look at. And I think in just 2 weeks or so, we'll be able to look at how we've fared during the first quarter. But again, that's almost all backward looking. You know, 5/6 of that report is backward looking. And as far as projections go, you may have seen, I know Jason's got it, I've got it, some of you have gotten it from NYSAC, that they've put out preliminary projections on how much each county may lose in sales tax dollars. And I think those numbers range for Tompkins County anywhere from $4 million to $8 million. And, you know, those are the only official projections that I've seen at this point, that, of course, they don't have much of a crystal ball more than we do. And I know that Jason wants to begin to put together some projections, you know, before we have our budget kickoffs. So I guess the short answer is no, we don't have anything in-house that's been prepared here on from my team, but we do have what the state has given us within just within the last week or so.
And what the state has taken away from us with this new new
and
chart.
What the state is, of course, you've seen those memos and those notes too, passed on how much is going to be taken.
All right, thank you.
Last
question, Martha, before we take a break quickly.
Yeah, you bet. How can they come do an audit? I mean, they're going to usually they physically come here and sit in the conference room with the books, right?
No, they will not be here physically at all. It's all done remotely.
Okay.
Everything scanned, emailed, sent. We use portals for sensitive information. We've been through all of our audits so far this year, 3 out of 5, and they've all been pretty much done remotely because they're working at home too.
Okay. And, great.
And so that's pretty clean and that's pretty efficient process. And so that part, that's one less fear.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you all very much. Let's take a quick 10-minute break. Be back here at 10 to 8 at 7:50. Okay? All right. Feed the dog, feed the cat, nice flower stand. All right. We are without a quorum. Seven, eight, nine. We are. All right. We are going to resume Tompkins County Legislature meeting. Glad everyone got their potato chips and whatever else to renew your coffee. Glenn is still eating his dinner. I have gummies. Okay. Let's go to our agenda. Consent agenda, resolutions and appointments to be voted on as a group unless any member of the legislature requests that a resolution or appointment be instead included separately and individually as part of the business of standing or special committee.
I got a question on number 10, though, first.
You have a question on number 10? Resolutions to be added or withdrawn from the agenda. Are there any resolutions to be added or withdrawn?
I have a question, if I may. Jason, are you recommending that we withdraw or not add the resolution regarding the airport?
Yes, Mike. I'm recommending you not add Resolution J and instead put that on the next probably F&I meeting and go and vote on that May 5th. I am suggesting you continue to move forward with the public hearing resolution.
Public hearing resolution. Okay. All right. I just want to make sure that's your recommendation because I was prepared to add it.
Yeah. I can explain briefly, Mike. There was an error on our part. It was really a procedural process. Really, the bid itself should be done after the the authorization to borrow is granted, because otherwise there is not an authorization to expend funds for the project. So you need to go through the seeker, then the bond, the ban resolution, then the bond amendment, and then the award bid, all on April 5th. That would be the order it would go in.
All right.
Okay, so Mike, you'll need to withdraw that because it's yours.
Do I withdraw it?
Yeah, because it's on the agenda.
All right, I will withdraw that at your recommendation.
Withdraw on Resolution J, filed by Legislator Lane. Thank you for that. Any other resolutions to be added or withdrawn? Seeing none. Everything I said about the consent agenda, resolutions that are not controversial or appointments, and don't need to be in as part of the regular business of standing or special committee. Where are the appointments, Kathy? Appointments? Let's go to advisory board appointments. To the Health and Human Services Committee, from Health and Human Services Committee, Office of the Aging Advisory Committee, we are appointing Wilma Lawrence, the term to expire December 31st, 2022. From Housing and Economic Development Committee, to the Downtown Ithaca Alliance, appointment of Anna Kellis, whose term will expire April 15th of 2022. Those are the appointments under our consent agenda. Moving on to resolutions on consent. From public safety, Resolution A, authorization to accept an award of a grant from the New York State Division of Criminal Justice Services, ID 9119. Under facilities and infrastructure, Resolution B, authorization to execute supplemental funding agreement with New York State Department of Transportation, PIN 3756.10 Pine Tree Road, County Route 176 intersection improvements, Town of Ithaca, New York, ID 9267. Resolution C, resolution authorizing a public hearing in accordance with Section 147F of the Internal Revenue Code of 1986 as amended, ID 9256. Under Government Operations Committee, Resolution D, budget adjustment, County Clerk, 2019 year end adjustments, 9250. ID. Under Planning, Energy, and Environmental Quality Committee, Resolution E, acceptance of snowmobile.
Yes.
Trail grant for the 2019-20 season, ID 9248. Resolution F, rescheduling a public hearing for the continuation of and modifications to Agricultural District Number 1, located on the east side of Cayuga Lake and encompassing the towns of Caroline, Dryden, Groton, Lansing, and parts of Danby and Ithaca, ID 9274. Under Housing and Economic Development Committee, Resolution G, appointments to Industrial Development Agency in Tompkins County Development Corporation Board of Directors, ID 9220. Resolution H, negative declaration for authorizing exemption from real property taxes and provision for in lieu payments with regard to Ithaca Neighborhood Housing Services, INHS, 46 South Street, Village Grove Project, ID 9260. Resolution I, authorize exemption for real property taxes and provisions for in-lieu payments with regard to Ithaca Neighborhood Housing Services, INHS,
British Grove Project ID 9271. Those are all the appointments and resolutions on consent agenda. Can I have someone move the consent agenda, please? Moved by Annie, seconded by Martha. All a roll call. So all in favor of the consent agenda, we'll do a roll call vote. Please unmute yourselves so that you can respond. Go ahead.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Graniston?
Yes.
Rich John?
Yes.
Anna Kellis?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Dan Corman? Ann Corman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Morey?
Yes.
Leslyn McBean Claiborne?
Yes.
14 ayes, 0 noes.
That carries unanimously. Thank you very much. On to standing and special committee reports. Downtown Facilities Committee, Dave McKenna, Chair.
Thank you, Leslyn. Downtown Facilities meeting was canceled this month, basically due to not having any idea how things are going to turn out in the near future. We kind of put things on hold. I don't know if Jason wants to expand on that anymore, but I'll leave it up to him.
So I'd love to hear a little bit more on that. Are we putting on hold because we're just not thinking that we're spending any money now because we don't know what the budget is going to look like? Is that the idea?
Yeah, right now we'll probably pick up a discussion next month. Yes, that's correct, Leslie.
Okay, but you probably pick it up next month. All right. Thank you for that. Any other questions for Dave? Thank you, Dave. Moving on, Public Safety Committee, Rich John, Chair.
Thank you, Leslyn. There are just a few things I'd like to share with the legislature. The number of emergency calls is down slightly, well, about 15%. I talked to Brian Robeson today. They're tracking the nature of the calls. They're trying to see if there's any trends related to domestic violence because of people staying home so much. He said they really haven't seen anything, but they're trying to pay attention to it. I also spoke with our sheriff today. The jail census is at 30 people. We have one board in because of a conflict at one of our neighboring county's jails that they agreed to take one person. That, as you know, is a historically low number. We were at 29 last week, so 30 is essentially static. The one issue that's, and I just say that they're separating people as far as possible at the jail. Anybody coming in is being quarantined for 14 days, and they're taking temperatures and looking for any other symptoms on a daily basis. They've instituted some practices for the inmates and the guards to make sure they're washing their hands as often as possible and practicing social distancing. The one issue we really have at our jail is that we have 7 people there on parole violations. And for all of the uproar at the state and local level, it appears like it's been business as usual on parole violations.
Yep.
So for anybody who might be watching this outside of the legislature, somebody can be violated from parole for a fairly minor infraction, such as missing a meeting with their parole officer. It can be other things, too. It can be failing a drug test, but it's essentially at the discretion of the parole officer to violate the person, and they then get placed in our jail waiting for a hearing. And our numbers would be 7 less than 30, so it'd be at 23, which would really be an improvement in terms of functionality if we weren't holding these 7 people. An administrative law judge is scheduled to come Thursday to have hearings, And so some of those people may get adjudicated and either released or sent on to New York State prison. It's also possible they'll just get held here. And for anybody whose hearing isn't reached, they may sit in our jail for another 30 days.
Jesus.
I think this is a real problem that New York State should address on a statewide basis if they're concerned about jail populations. Because you can see in our jail, it's you know, roughly a quarter of the people in our jail are on parole violations. And obviously the remainder of the people, there's some pretty good reason why they're there. You know, they've done something pretty severe to be in our jail. If it's a nonviolent situation or there's some other alternative, the courts and the district attorney and defense counsel have worked pretty hard to find those alternatives. But parole still remains a problem. I'm happy to try to answer any questions.
Thank you, Rich. Anna, Martha, then Dan.
Thank you, Rich. Thank you for always being on top of that, the status. Lance Salisbury gave us a brief update of the rollbacks, the bail reform rollback. I'd really like to hear more about that in the next meeting, if that's possible. He started to discuss the expected impact on our jail population, if that's possible.
Certainly, that is going to be covered. Our next meeting of the Public Safety Committee is the 16th, April 16th at 3 o'clock, right here on Zoom. And you are all invited. I prefer to have it discussed there because generally you're going to have Lance there and also our district attorney, Matt Van Houten.
Right.
So you get sort of the two sides of the issue. But there have been some changes to the bail reform laws that were passed in 2019. So they've been adjusted somewhat. I listened to a program where the New York State head of the District Attorneys Association was talking about the changes. And he said, you know, there was more they were looking for. They didn't get everything, but he thought it was an improvement from the district attorney's side. But we will be talking about that at our upcoming meeting.
It would be good if we could just get a bit of a balance because, of course, you know, I know the DA side thinks of it as a good thing. The defense counsel thinks of it as a bad thing. I'd love to make sure we have both.
All right.
Sure.
Thank you. Martha, then Dan.
Thanks, Lesnar. Thanks, Rich. Jason, I guess probably a question to Jason. I know you're on calls and, you know, talking to state people all the time. Is there any way to get this concern about parole sent up the ladder, if this, whether it's the commission or whoever? I'm sure if it's affecting us, it's affecting other counties too.
Yeah, I can check in with DA and Lance too, and just get an understanding of the cases, and I can talk to the governor's rep about it as well, and see if I can get anywhere with it. It doesn't hurt. I mean, the governor's released, I forget the number. I want to say 1,100 or 1,300 parolees already. You know, if these are low offenses and or something that we can work through, we'll see. Rich, you said the administrative law judge was coming this week?
Thursday. So we may see that number go down. I hope so.
Yeah. Maybe I'll touch base with the sheriff and Ray Blunts first and just see what the schedule looks like and who it is. I'll poke around a little bit so I can find out.
Terrific. Thank you.
No problem.
Thank you. Dan?
Yeah, we've heard in other municipalities, other locations, that they are freeing some prisoners. We've heard it brought up locally. I believe I read a statement from our sheriff that said he needs the state to say that. If that was to happen locally, he doesn't have that power. So could Rich or maybe Jonathan, can you confirm if that's true and state that clearly for the public, please?
Could you repeat what the statement is?
I'm using your laptop.
They're maybe coming over here.
You're having trouble hearing me?
Yes.
It's like a double echo type of thing going on.
It's right here. So I think we just stand.
The question is that we've seen prisoners being released in other locations. We've had it asked about locally. And I believe our sheriff said that he does not have the power to do that, that we have to come from the state. So I was asking for confirmation of that and to say that clearly for the public, please.
I guess I'd need to explore that a bit. Certainly the local judges have worked with the defense counsel and the DA and reviewed cases, and that's part of the reason our numbers are so low. They could go back and revisit sentences, but that would be up to the judges. So I'm not sure what New York State would be doing on fairly minor charges, but this again, and I haven't really heard that, so I need to think about it. And I would certainly try to get you an answer. I don't know if Jonathan has anything further.
Thank you.
Has everybody heard me?
Not at all.
No. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, parolees are creatures of the state, if for want of a better word. It's completely a state program. Under law, they have the right to keep them in our jail for a certain period of time. They pay for that, but obviously they take up jail space. They have their own procedures. So it really is, I mean, the sheriff is correct, it really is out of his authority. The state basically has the authority to dump or place, you know, parolees in our jail for up to 30 days. Obviously they pay for that, but that doesn't necessarily alleviate all our problems. And in the past, I mean, they've done a better job in recent years of actually moving them out. They used to not move them out. In fact, many years ago, we actually sued them and won. But it is really a state right so long as they stay within the parameters that are given to them.
Okay, you read my mind, Jonathan. Go.
Can I just ask, too, so what about non-parolees?
Yeah, that's what I thought you were asking about, Dan.
Yeah, yes, I am.
Okay, so Rich will look into it and try to get an answer for you. Henry.
Yes, Rich. You talked about the testing, well, the thermometer testing of the inmates. Has there also been COVID-19 regular tests of the inmates?
You know, I certainly can't reveal anything that happened with any particular inmate, and I wasn't informed that by the sheriff, but I was told that if there was anybody displaying any symptoms, they would be tested.
Okay.
Yes, Deborah.
Thank you.
Hold on, Deborah. Are you done, Henry?
Yes, I'm done.
Okay, Deborah.
Well, in response to Dan's question, what I saw and heard on social media and elsewhere was that what was said was it wasn't up to us to release people in the jail, that they were there by judicial order and it would be up to the judges to do that. But my question for Rich is, does this administrative law judge only come once every 30 days or once a month?
Correct. Once a month. And the problem is that if you try to have them come in and hear seven cases, they may not get to them all. And so it just rolls over to the next calendar. You know, we've talked to the parole division to see if we could cycle through an administrative law judge more often. You know, we haven't, and we, of course, we tried to get them interested in our alternatives to incarceration programs. And there was a little interest in that. We had a couple, a few instances where parolees were, say, put into day reporting instead of sent to our jail. But that seems to have gone by the wayside. I don't know why.
So if the administrative law judge doesn't get to this person's case, at the end of the 30 days, are they released? Or
no. No, they remain our guest for another 30 days or until the judge comes back.
Wow.
All right. Thank you, Henry. Do you have your hand up again? Henry, you have to start over because we can't hear you.
He's muted.
We're trying to unmute you. There you go.
Okay. And in New Jersey, the courts and the state agreed to release 1,000 inmates of low-level crimes to release them. And I assume that's what Derek meant, that if New York had to do it, they'd have to agree to release them. And New York so far has not agreed to release anyone on a low-level offense.
That could be. Certainly the judges in the individual cases could reopen them and resentence. But I haven't heard that of that actually happening, and I haven't heard anything from New York State, but that's what I'll try to find out.
All right. Anything else, Rich?
Nope, that's it.
All right, thank you. Health and Human Services Committee, Shauna Black, Chair.
Hi there. Thank you. We have not had a meeting since our last legislature meeting. Our next meeting will be Monday, April 20th. At 1 p.m., and we will have a Zoom meeting. And at this point, we are keeping our agenda open. I have not seen any resolutions come forth, and we might have a presentation. So I will keep everyone posted. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Shauna? No? Wonderful. Facilities and Infrastructure Committee, Mike Lane, Chair.
We met on March 19th had a brief meeting, and then had a joint meeting with the Budget and Capital and Personnel Committee. Mostly what our agenda consisted of was the bonding resolutions for the airport program that would be coming to the legislature in the May meeting, including scheduling the public hearing. And now this fourth resolution about the bid, since we've taken it not doing it at this meeting, we'll be doing it also in May. Our next meeting is April 16th.
Thank you. Questions for Mike? Wonderful. Moving on. Government Operations Committee, Amanda Champion, Chair.
Hello. Thank you. Let's see, we met last Thursday, April 2nd, and we tried to have a fairly short meeting. I think we were the first committee to use the Zoom platform, so we're kind of still working out a few of the kinks. We had lots of reports from various staff, which was great, and we did talk very briefly about the redistricting topic, and it kind of got lost in the past month of everything else happening, and we did not sort of move that discussion forward. I'm going to put together a few thoughts, and we're going to try to make some progress next month. One thing to keep in mind is that, you know, the census is being pushed back and extended a bit. That means it's very likely that the census data coming back to us is going to be delayed as well. So that's going to affect, you know, our possible redistricting commission, all that kind of stuff. So it definitely needs a little bit more thought and discussion, which we're planning to do at the next meeting. The only resolution, and I can bring this up now, or we can wait until. Do you want me to do it now, Leslin?
The one urging the governor that it was put as a member filed resolution.
Right. We actually did talk about that, and we voted on that at GO.
At GO? Okay, then yes.
And it did pass at GO 4-1. So
definitely you can introduce it now as part of your GO.
Okay. So that is on your agenda's resolution K. urging the governor and legislature of New York State to quickly enact provisions to conduct the June 23rd primary election by mail. And Martha worked on this primarily, which was great, and we had some good discussion about it. I guess I would go ahead and move that.
Move. May I have a second, please? Seconded by Martha. She had her hand raised.
And if I may, Martha, if you want to just say a few words about your thoughts about it, and then if there's questions, we can do that.
Martha, you're muted.
You're muted.
Thanks, Amanda, and I'm really glad that Gio had a chance to talk it through and add a few things to it to make it better. And Elizabeth Cree and Steve also weighed in, and we understand, they understand it'll take more effort and some different processes depending upon what the state does. The resolution really says we urge that all residents just be mailed an absentee ballot. And rather than ask people to go through a two-step process of ask for an applicant, you know, apply for a ballot and have to, at this point, we'd be asking them to basically lie because you have to have a reason, you have to have an excuse, and fear of COVID is not on the excuse list. So we wanted to avoid the idea of a two-step process. If the state just mails, state has everybody get an absentee ballot by mail, that makes it one process. So I hope that the state's obviously a state decision. I hope that we can get this moving, maybe encourage other counties to also send this to the state and try to get this done in time. There is time, I think, if they do it now, rather than in Wisconsin, as we saw today's primary being a kind of train wreck because they had no time and certainly no agreement on what to do. So I hope we can get this up the ladder and get them to pay attention. Thank you.
Yeah, and I'll just want to add one thing. Stephen and Elizabeth, you know, they were a little bit hesitant because of, you know, the amount of work. They did say that they would require more space to, you know, deal with all of this. And Jason was there, and he said that they could certainly find them some space to do that.
All right. Any questions? Deborah.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention that it's important that if the state's going to make this change, they need to do it well in advance of the actual election date, because the Supreme Court reversed the Wisconsin Supreme Court today and held that make a change to the election proceedings or the date on the eve of the election itself, which suggests that one of the things the courts may be looking at, if anything like this is challenged, is how far in advance a change is made.
Thank you for that, Deborah. Anna Kellis?
Yeah, I don't know if I have the most up-to-date version. I'm curious if there was language that was added in that these were, they had postage on them. My concern is that we are sending out absentee ballots, and most people don't carry around postage with them anymore, and then we're going to be sending tons of people to the post office, which isn't necessarily, it sort of defeats the purpose of everybody congregating for a vote itself. I know that that is obviously expensive, but I think that we've sort of determined that we do things based off of political will at this point. And if this is something that we really believe in, I think we should ask the state to invest in. So it's something I would like to see included.
Thank you, Anna. Martha, you have a response?
It looked like Amanda was about to say something.
Well, I was going to ask Anna if you want to make an amendment. That is not something that we talked about. I guess I personally would, I mean, I think you make a valid point, but I would hope that the state would kind of work those details out themselves. But, yeah.
I know that it's something that's happening at the state among some progressive lobby groups. I have not heard anything being added at the state level. So, yes, I would like to offer an amendment to make sure that there's equity in voting, putting anybody at risk right now.
And your amendment is? Do you have some wording?
I would say that, you know, simple wording that the absentee ballots include the postage. Absentee ballots are mailed out, including postage return. I don't know that, but I think it's just postage.
Where are you adding that, Anna? That the first resolve? By mailing all voters the ballots, including postage. Yes.
Do you not have it in front of you? Because it was emailed by Kathy yesterday.
I think she's on mute.
She's getting to it.
Okay.
You still searching, Anna?
I'm looking for the updated. But, Leslyn, that is sufficient to me, what you just said. So I don't want you to wait on.
Okay, so the first resolve.
Correct. That worked for me.
The third line says, June 23rd primary to be conducted mostly by mail. Preferably by mailing all voters a ballot, including return postage.
Correct. That is what I'm looking at right now. And yes, Martha, I am looking at the resolution.
Okay.
Where I would put it.
So is that the language you would like to add?
Correct.
Okay.
Very simple.
So, Anne is offering an amendment. Is there someone who would like to second that amendment?
I would say
seconded
friendly.
By Dan. No, not Dan. Shauna.
Is it friendly?
Yeah, I think that's friendly.
Okay. Thank you for speaking up that it is friendly.
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 Thank you.
Friendly to the mover and seconder. Other comments? Mike Lane and then Martha.
If you want the state to pay the postage, you better say it, because the ballots will be mailed out by our county board of elections, and if it's the state will be glad to tell us to put the postage stamps on it.
The next line says, and to provide the resources necessary to accomplish this task.
Exactly.
So that would include the return postage.
Exactly.
Okay.
I really hope that wouldn't prevent the state from doing this. Really, we can't afford what's happening in Wisconsin. It's just not fair. And but if they do it soon, they'll have the time to make this as efficient and painless as possible. So I would really hope that the cost of it is not going to be a barrier.
All right, thank you, Martha. Speaking to the amendment, Henry, and then Rich.
I wanted to say that Amanda said that this was a 4-1 vote, But I missed a GEO meeting, so it couldn't have been 4-0.
Oh,
well,
yeah.
4-1. It must have been 3-1.
Yeah, sorry. Yes.
Okay. And I was also wondering, did anyone talk about, I know the other side or the Republicans talk about the fraud issue involved in this. Did anybody at GEO discuss the issue of the of fraud?
We did not discuss that. Nope.
Okay.
All right, folks, remember we're speaking to the amendment. Rich?
Yeah, I have concern that if we're going to ask New York State to pay a lot of postage, that may become a point of argument. I understand the equity issue, but do we want to make it harder for them to say yes? I guess that's what I'm struggling with. I would be in favor of just leaving that language out. If somebody wants to vote, maybe they need to pay postage, especially when New York State has a budget that is just going to be awful. They're going to be scraping in the couch for the quarters.
All right. This is a simple amendment, so we don't need to debate it all night. Martha and then Anna.
I would just remind folks that most of these resolutions, maybe all of them, if we're lucky, somebody reads the title. So, we're just kind of telling, we're going to send this up the flagpole, and certainly if we want other counties to also sign on, I think it's helpful if we include this, and this will get duked out in Albany anyway, but mostly it's what the title is what matters.
All right, this was a friendly amendment. Again, friendly yes. Amendment.
Yes.
All right, Anna and then Mike Lane.
I would just add thank you to Martha. I agree with you on that. And I would just add that marginalized people have been scraping for quarters in their couches for way longer. And that is, the two combination of making it equitable and also the whole purpose of doing this is to keep people from congregating. It's a one small amendment. If the state doesn't want to add it, they, I'm sure, will not be so intimidated by our resolution that they wouldn't do it altogether. They'll remove it themselves. So I just feel like it's important to make the point of standing on the side of equity and safety right now.
Okay. Mike Lean.
Could we know who voted against this and if that person could tell us why they voted against it?
It was an error. You probably hear that very.
No, it was 3-1. Henry was not there. I misspoke. Sorry. Mike Sigler was the person who voted against it, and he did not give us his reasons at the time. He's welcome to now if he wants to.
I mean, I expect this to pass. I don't particularly care to tell the state what we think that they should do. I think this is on their radar. They clearly know what's going on. I don't necessarily think this is the best solution to it. I don't really know what the best solution is to it.
All right, fair enough. Thank you.
I've always had a problem with early voting because I think it stemming before the COVID-19, I think early voting does a detriment to candidates. It literally shortens the electoral agenda, the time they have to campaign. I mean, frankly, if you're going to open this up right now to mail-in voting, I mean, how early can we get that ballot? If you can get it a month before the election, well, then, frankly, your election is now in May. That concerns me. I mean, a lot of things can happen in a month. And it really, you're voting for something that you don't really know the whole situation at that period of time. So, yeah, I have concerns about that. And
all right, thank you.
I'm not as concerned about the fraud. I mean, other people are, but that's not my main concern. My main concern is what I just said. Thanks.
All right, I'm going to go ahead and call for a vote. So, roll call vote.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
No.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Granison?
Yes.
Rich John?
Yes.
Anna Kellis?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Morey?
Yes.
Leslyn McBean-Claiborne?
Yes.
13 ayes, 1 no.
That carries. Thank you very much. Thank you, Gio, Martha, Elvis, for bringing this. Anything else from Gio, Amanda?
Just to say that our next meeting is May 7th at 1:45. Also, I assume we'll be on Zoom at that point still. And I'm not really sure what's going to be on the agenda. I think we're going to kind of see how things go in the next couple of weeks. And that's all. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Amanda. Planning, Energy, and Environmental Quality Committee, Deborah Dawson, Chair.
Hi, yes, thank you. We had the leanest and meanest of peak meetings on the 23rd and passed the two resolutions that were on the on the agenda. And that's all I've got. We will meet again on the 27th. And as urgent as environmental and climate issues are, they're not as immediate as coronavirus. So I think we'll be sticking to lean and mean for the foreseeable future.
Thank you. Any questions for Deborah? No. Moving on. Budget, Capital, and Personnel Committee. Martha Robertson, Chair.
Thank you, Leslyn. We've met twice since the last we met March 9th and especially March 19th. The March 19th was with facilities and infrastructure to talk about to pass the airport resolutions. We will meet on Monday at, I blanked on the time, 3:00, I think. And what we're really going to do, I mean, we'll get reports, in particular, we'll certainly need reports from Jason, Rick, and Lisa about personnel. But we'll also be talking about kind of, and there's a one-page list of kind of questions and issues that I put together, and that's in the agenda packet. So it'll be used to sort of structure our conversation about how do we move forward? How do we evaluate mid-year budget cuts? How do we look at what's incoming, what's not coming in, what extra costs might be? And how do we prepare for the retreat? Do we even have the ability to set a fiscal target the way we usually do, on April 28th, or do we have a second retreat? So there's a lot going on. Jason and I had a good conversation this morning, and those will continue. So we did, as I mentioned earlier, the state budget was passed last week, and among the things in there was our airport bonding bill, a home rule bill that will allow us to bond for the airport project on the 30-year time frame. That will save us about $565,000 a year during the whole period, the 30 years. We the Medicaid arrangement, and I will say I think the legislature really, really took to heart NYSAC's position and the lobbying that counties did. And it really appears from the media and the reports I've gotten that the legislature stood very strong against the governor's proposals, which on Medicaid, which as we knew were really going to be very difficult for counties and got worse with the virus. At the end of the day, it looks like approximately NYSAC's estimated the hit to counties on sales tax for the next 2 years. This is the thing that we basically traded away instead of the Medicaid redesign team cuts, and instead of the governor rejecting the $6.7 billion in new federal Medicaid money, the deal they crafted takes 2% of our sales tax to fund a new fund for hospitals and nursing homes that are in stress. So it's not money that goes directly to the general fund of the state. it's going to help out hospitals and nursing homes. 2 years worth of 2% of our tax, and NYSAC estimated for Tompkins County about $333,000 a year. Just obviously a number that's a placeholder at best. Probably the biggest thing that is going to be a threat to us is the governor's, the new authority that he negotiated and won to basically recalculate the budget three times in the next 9 months. So the April 30th, June 30th, and at the end of the year. Jason, is that are those the right dates when the Division of Budget has the opportunity to recalculate?
April 30th, June 30th, and December 31st.
Okay, so they have negotiated the ability to recalculate the revenues that would come to counties and other partners. So that's obviously going to be a challenge for us. I assume NYSAC is going to continue to keep us informed, and if there's additional lobbying that we can do, then I hope everybody here was a great team on pushing back. So stay tuned. There will probably be more to do. So that's a summary from the NYSAC report, and these are among the things that we're going to be looking at and talking about at the budget meeting next week.
Wonderful. Thank you, Martha. Questions? Mike Lane?
Yes, Martha, I'm glad you mentioned about this fund that we have to do for 2 years. This is on top of the raid last year on our sales tax for the AIM funding for the towns and villages. So depending on where we end up, we could be looking at a loss of our sales tax in for at least the next 2 years of the $750,000. And I personally don't trust that this thing will sunset in 2 years. And if it does, you can be sure now that the state's found the slippery slope, they're going to find other reasons to raid our sales tax. To me, if they want sales tax, they should do their own increase of sales tax and not look to us knowing that we have to raise our real property taxes when we lose our sales tax.
I know. I think the governor hates the fact that counties get to rate to actually charge sales tax. There was a comment in one of his budget presentations about, you know, no other counties get to raise their own sales tax. And I'm like, that's not true at all. But you're right.
Oh, well, it's one leverage we have, and we're going to hold on to it. Thank you, Martha. Henry, you have your hand raised? Yes. Do you have a question?
Martha, is it time yet to start talking about the TC3 budget?
Oh, yeah, TC3 is going to come on Monday. And sorry, I forgot to mention that. Jason organized that. They'll be coming on Monday to tell us where we, you know, what their finances look like. And
no, Martha, we're not buying them.
I didn't say that. I mean, maybe I said that. It's Rich's idea.
I'm messing with you.
Well, are they going to do the same kind of budget presentation with the Cortland legislators and us?
Well, I assume they have to. And one of the things we did, Jason and I did talk about, was what kind of direction do we give to the other process of the other institutions that have feed budget information into us, like STPB and Human Services Coalition, TCAT and the library, and TC3, of course. And, you know, does the calendar shift in any way? So those are the kinds of things we have time to talk about on Monday to try to – we want people to be able to estimate with the most accurate information they have. And everything is changing. You know, it changes daily. So we can't just – I don't think there's any purpose to picking a fiscal target out of thin air. So we'll just – these are the kinds of things we really have to chew over as we figure out forward.
So join the meeting on Monday.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Okay, moving on.
Thank you.
Workforce Diversity and Inclusion Committee, Annie Cronin, Chair, anything from you, Annie?
Thank you, Leslyn. So we had our last meeting canceled in March, and then the next one is in April the 22nd, and I'm not sure whether we're going to meet yet. But I had two concerns regarding the type of issues that our committee does address. Two things. The first thing was our employees getting paid throughout this whole pandemic through the end of April. Just wondering about that, thinking about our most vulnerable populations in the workforce.
Amy, Lisa, are you asking of our staff?
Yes, they are. And the governor's executive order states that, you know, employees who cannot report to work and cannot telework will be paid leave, and their accruals won't be charged. So the county has granted emergency leave for all employees who cannot either report to work or work from home.
Is that current? Thank you. Is that currently through the April 29th?
It's through April 15th, and then as per the governor's executive order, which extends through April 29th, we plan to follow suit, yes. We have not yet had the opportunity to communicate with that with staff because we were just clarifying that executive order was extended, but that is the plan, yes.
Okay, thank you, because I know we're coming up on the 15th. And then my second issue I just want to keep an eye on, as Henry mentioned earlier, there's some data coming out regarding the COVID, the people that COVID is affecting, and it seems to be in larger municipalities, largely affecting people of Latinx and African American those populations. And so I don't know if that would be for our human rights department to look at. One of the things that I'm wondering is why wait till we get this data if we already know that this affects those people disproportionately? Is there anything we should be doing? And again, I don't know if that's who would be addressing that. Or HHS, I'm not sure.
I think it looks like Jason and or Amy or.
I think this is a broader question about the data and information that we're going to be able to collect, Annie. But I think it's probably something that we can continue to consider. Our GARE, we've joined GARE, that membership program, has been watching this at the national level and has provided some information on it. The challenge that we have is the demographic and the identifying characteristics when we break it down. And so we'll continue to do it. I don't know what committee level you want to go with, but probably it's something that we can work with you on.
Okay, thank you. So maybe we can have a conversation offline about it then?
Yeah, that sounds good.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you. Henry, is it related?
Yes, it's related to how that Ken Clark, the Director of Human Rights, also wrote a piece about the anti-Asian American backlash that's been in the county and telling people to report it. And so I just wanted to mention that how we're up on that issue. I assume Ann would also agree with that. That again, we want to. Stamp out that kind of anti-racist kind of racism that's going on in the county.
Sounds like a topic for Workforce Diversity Inclusion Committee to pick up.
Thank you.
Maybe suggest a resolution or something. Martha?
Are we taking demographic information on when we do testing?
Not sure. I don't know the answer to that question.
I know it's obviously sensitive and people should only be asked to report if they want to or whatever, but if you don't have the data, we don't know if there's disproportionate impact.
I can respond to that. As far as the data or the articles that I've seen about it, they say they actually didn't have the information from testing. They had to call coroners and get that information. That's how they got it.
Okay. Anything else, Annie?
No, thank you.
Martha, you said have your hand raised?
If the staff and CMC could think about it, if that's something to do, to ask people if they would self-report on race or ethnicity, so that we might track that. So thank goodness so far we don't have to ask any coroners, but it would be good to know what our experience is locally.
We can ask, but again, if people choose not to. And that would be a CMC call as well, although we can certainly suggest. Can't make CMC do anything.
Yes, I also want to note that the United States is also not collecting gender data, which is amazing, but I put out there that they're not collecting gender data, even though men are supposedly more at risk.
All right. Thank you very much. Tommy and the Intergovernmental Relations Committee, Martha Robertson Chair, is there anything else from you?
Yeah, just back to that. I, of course, are we collecting gender data?
Say that again.
Henry just made me think, are we collecting data on gender? I don't see it reported. There are a lot of counties that are reporting a lot of detail like that, gender, age, et cetera, but are we, not that we need to report it, tallying that when we do the testing?
We're not tallying it. Yes. So I don't know if it's being reported.
Okay. All right. Intergovernmental relations, just that last week I finished up the week writing sort of thank you notes to the legislators and to NYSAC and the governor's people that we'd been in touch with for all the work that they'd done and for the, on our behalf, fairly balanced outcome. I don't see anything at the moment on the horizon for that kind of advocacy at this point. I actually can't remember, I confess. I think a few people volunteered for this to be an actual committee, and Leslin and I were going to.
It is.
Right. I don't actually remember, I'm embarrassed to say, who raised their hands to say that they.
Eileen, Deb Dawson, Anna Kellis, we had Shauna Black. Those were the people. Did I have that right?
No, I don't think so.
There were five people. There were only five people.
Okay, tell you what. Everybody send me.
We'll go back at the last minutes and see who they were, because okay, at the last legislature meeting, people were appointed right there on the floor.
Okay. All right. Then I'll take it from there. Thank you very much.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Housing and Economic Development Committee, Anna Kellis. Chair.
So our next meeting is on Thursday, the 23rd at 9:30 in the morning. We have been pushing the discussion of our annual priorities for this year. I think that we will continue to push that until the crisis is settled. I am reaching out to or have begun discussions with Natalie. As Jason said earlier this evening, she's been doing amazing work to try and help jumpstart our economic recovery already by reaching out to businesses, finding out what their needs are. In the daily summaries I've been putting out, I know there was one Jason has sent out. It has been on social media. That she has created a list through the Workforce Development Board as the new director, a list of businesses that have jobs that are actually seeking employees. So I encourage people to look at those locations. We're continuing to send out information. I know legislators have been sending that out, so I wanted to bring her in to talk about the work that she's been doing. She's been with us for a short period of time, but she jumped in hook, line, and sinker. So I think that's one of people's biggest concerns is how we're starting to into economic recovery. So I think for the next couple months, that's going to be the focus of the housing and economic development meetings. And again, that is on March 23rd at 9:30 in the morning. That's a Thursday.
You mean April
23rd? Sorry, April 23rd. Wow, this month has gone really fast. It is.
That's all right. And for all of you talking about recovery, there's nothing wrong with having those discussions. What I want to caution is that, we are not presenting as if we're, pitting one organization against the other or, sending messages that, something is much more important than the other when we haven't had a real full-fledged discussion. It's great to take a look at things from a macro level, knowing that eventually we have to get there to start to begin planning. But when we start thinking of individual organizations, we really start to create panic, and I want to encourage you to please be mindful of that. If we feel conversations are sort of strained that way, as chairs, to please, sort of dial it back, pull it back, so again, that we don't begin to create unnecessary panic where it doesn't need to be.
Yeah, so Leslyn, I'll just, this is definitely a macro level from one of our departments, on a report on her work. I'm not sure about any independent or individual agencies or organizations, but the intention of this is a report out from one of the departments that reports to the committee.
Right. Just a general comment to all of us. All right. Thank you, Anna. Any questions for Anna? Wonderful. Thank you very much. Complete Census Count Committee, Mike Lane, Chair.
Our committee met on the just last Monday, and we had a full complement. We did a Zoom meeting as well. We heard from the two census specialists who were assigned to Tompkins County, Michael Kaplink-Alaire and Jennifer Carius. Michael reported to us that our response rate for the census materials that have been sent out to people already, and people have been responding, was 42.9%. He said that was below the national average, but it was above the state average, to give you some idea. Jennifer Carius has been working strongly with the three colleges, the Cornell University, Ithaca College, and Tompkins Corley Community College, because we know that getting an accurate count of the students for our county is particularly important, and they have been pushing out a lot of information. The colleges have been putting out information. We saw some video with the message to the people that have gone home that even if they've gone home, they are responsible to report their home for the census purposes at their college address. They're not quite so worried about the dormitories, but they are a little concerned about getting the count for some of the great fraternities that aren't Cornell-owned, and also the graduate students or other students who live off campus. So they're working on that. They're trying to get the information out. Anybody who hasn't had a chance to fill out your form, please do that. We've been handicapped here because of the COVID, like so many other programs, but we have to keep this in the forefront because it means so much to us for our grant possibilities of the future and our representation in Congress also for the legislature.
So we will be meeting again in May, of course, but in the meantime, we will continue to work trying to get the word out. Our Public Information Advisory Board has a meeting scheduled, I believe, this week, and they'll be also working to come up with plans that are a little different than we had before, because really the banners and things that we were talking about, the idea of having a large press conference aren't working out because of the social distancing. But we are also concerned that there can be people who will be reached through social media, for example. We're trying a strong effort there. Our idea of the mobile outreach, which we were going to go out to some of the libraries and other senior houses and things, unfortunately hasn't worked out. We also don't know what's going on with the state grant funding, which, as you know, was sort of a yo-yo going back to last December, when it was first announced we were going to qualify, then we weren't going to qualify, and then we were going to qualify. And Nick Murphy reported that they've heard nothing from the state because the state is so wound up with everything it's having to do about the COVID virus epidemic here. So that's pretty much what we heard and talked about. I know a number of you were also tuned into the meeting. I thank you for being part of it.
Thank you, Mike. Questions for Mike? Let's all continue to push the census and encourage all our constituents to make sure they respond. It's really easy online. Please push it. That's a message that we could be pushing. Anything? Any unfinished business? No? Moving on to the minutes of the previous meeting, March 17th, 2020 minutes. May I have someone move the minutes, please? Moved by Amy, seconded by Deborah. And yet, Martha has her hand up. Any corrections?
Yes, I do. Packet page. I'm sorry I didn't get these to you before, Kathy, but packet page 33, about two-thirds down the page, it was noted that nursing homes are closed for business now. The governor has ordered that. I assume that means closed for visitors.
Yes.
Nursing home.
Yeah.
Okay. And then on packet page 42, the Intergovernmental Relations Committee, it certainly wasn't just myself that met with Lifton and O'Mara. So if I can suggest, Ms. Robertson, chair, said a number of legislators were able to meet with Assemblywoman Lifton and Senator O'Mara and by phone with Senator Helming.
Martha, can I ask that you send that to me because...
Yeah, that's all. Yeah.
Was that a yes? You'll send those corrections to Kathy?
Yeah, absolutely. I just want to make it clear. It wasn't just me. It was a lot of legislators and some staff, too. I'll send that to you, Kathy.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Other corrections? Comments on the minutes? Roll call vote?
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Please go ahead and unmute yourselves.
Yes.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Granison?
Yes.
Rich John?
Yes.
Anna Kellis?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Foreman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Morey?
Yes.
Leslyn McBean Claiborne?
Yes.
14 ayes, 0 no.
The minutes carries. Rich, do you have your hand up?
Thank you. Pardon me for going back to the census, but I actually had procrastinated until today, and I went on and did my filing for the household. And by our next meeting, it would be really nice if we had 14 people that could say their households had responded, so we had a clear message from the legislature. So I just ask all my colleagues if they could take the 20 minutes it takes to do it.
Mayor, right,
thanks.
You're getting thumbs up and waves and all that other good stuff.
Maybe we're already there, but
try it now.
We should make that statement.
Yeah, let's see. Everybody now filed, give it a thumbs up.
You're getting high fives and thumbs up and claps and everything else. So thank you all very much. Is there anything else before we adjourn this meeting? Thank you all. I know these meetings have been just a little bit long because we get the reports and briefing from Jason and the folks in the EOC, Frank and the folks in the EOC. But I appreciate your patience. It's good information for us. Thank you, public, for, well, no, the public isn't tuning in, but you'll see the reports. They are. We're streaming that they can see. Thank you very much. Keep sending us your questions. And we'll try to respond and read them to the record as well. Thank you all. Have a good night, everyone.
Thank you.
Stay safe. Wear your mask. Stay home. Wash your hands. Face. All of the above. Thank you.
Yes, Mom. Thank you, Leslie.
Thank you, Leslie.
Thank you. Good night.
Bye.